I feel like our world is a little upside down.
Did you roll over in your Wrangler?
No, I didn't roll over my Wrangler, but we're going to talk about that. Since you brought it up, I guess we can just start with follow-up. And coincidentally, in the very first item in follow-up, we have more Wrangler talk to have.
Awesome.
First of all, I wanted to publicly commend both John and Marco for John giving Marco the material with which to make a truly hilarious pre-show. And I had several people very kindly reach out to say, oh my God, John was on fire. Well, oftentimes it was John was on fire beating you up, but at the very least it was John was on fire.
I wasn't beating you up, bro. That's the whole thing. Like, first of all, you brought the topic of the show and said, I have a problem. I'm thinking about a Wrangler. So it's like it's you true. Saying, convince me not to get a Wrangler. And so I was trying to do what you asked. That's not a problem. Like, if you're saying, I'm thinking about a Jeep Wrangler, but you phrased it as like a problem situation.
Like, if you were really enthusiastic about it, saying, like, look, I've decided to make a life change. I have found who I really am now, and who I really am is a Jeep Wrangler person. Like, we would have been supportive of you as your friends.
Can I, if I get a Wrangler, if I end up with a Wrangler, can I try to find a license plate that's TOPLISS?
No, you are not allowed to do that.
No, you can't.
Come on.
You are not allowed to have a giant Lisp pun for the rest of your life.
Oh, come on.
No.
Anyway, so we have some follow up with regard to. Oh no, you distracted me. I was trying to compliment you two, and you've distracted me. So anyway, Marco did a very good job editing down 30 minutes of garbage into 8 minutes of pure comedy gold. That was mostly on account of John giving Marco the raw material with which to carve comedy gold out of it. So thank you to the two of you. Even though I am slightly annoyed with you, I still find that conversation hilarious. But we have some follow up about Wranglers from David Crawford, who writes in. Casey, you can tell John that this is the guy with the yellow 458 Speciale. I hope I pronounced that right. I think I did. Anyway.
Quadrifoglio.
Yeah, exactly. And I can drive anything I want. But when I run out to the garage to grab a car to run around town, I jump in my Jeep Wrangler. My Jeep is heavily modified and was not intended as a daily driver, but I find myself driving it more than anything because it's fun and nimble around town. Any thoughts, John?
I buy the fun part. Nimble?
Nimble? Hmm. Yeah.
I think fair. I think nimble in this context means it's not a terribly long car, although I believe it was a four-door.
I mean, anyway. Like, it spends a lot of time on two wheels. It's very nimble.
Oh, God. Here we go.
That's the thing about the Jeep Wrangler, like, specifically for you. It strikes me, well, first of all, for this choice of cars, if you've got a Ferrari, a fancy Ferrari or a Jeep, neither one of those is really a great car to, you know, drive around as a regular car, because you're not going to take your Ferrari to try to, like, go grocery shopping and scrape the front end trying to go into a gas station or whatever. And a Jeep, like fun cars like that, whether they're fun sporty cars or fun, like, off-roady cars, they're not really fun to go on, like, a 45-minute highway trip in a Jeep Wrangler or a Ferrari. Like, that's not what they're about. Seems to me that you're still, as far as we can tell, looking for like a, what they call a daily driver, like a car that you can use every day. And yeah, you can use a Jeep every day and you could use a Ferrari every day, but they're both, there's a lot of big compromises with both of those things. And thus far, you've been looking at cars that are more like regular cars that also happen to have a fun side to them, right? So that's why I don't think either one of these cars is a good choice for you. So forget about the 458. I know that was the second one on your list, but
yes, totally within my budget. I don't know. I thought it was funny, nevertheless, that here's someone that could really drive anything, and they choose to drive their Jeep.
That's why I suggested a go-kart. Remember that? You think it was like I'm making a joke? I don't know if that was cut or whatever. I suggested a go-kart because like it's like a fun toy to have. Like you can tool around on that, and it's a vehicle, but you're not going to bring it on roads. But it's just fun, right? It's way more fun than you would think because you're so low to the ground, and even when it doesn't go fast, it feels fast, and it corners, and you've driven go-karts, right? They're fun. And it gets that out of your system, so you can just have a regular car that like works and keeps out the weather and doesn't roll over and is safe and all that good stuff.
Fair enough. All right, we got to get out of neutral. I'm sorry. Let's talk about the iMac Pro since we're not going to do any of that today. We can dive right in and say that the iMac Pro RAM upgrades, and this is Renee Ritchie, I guess, saying you can't upgrade the RAM yourself, but you can take it to an Apple store or certified service center and they can upgrade for you. What now?
That's right from Renee Ritchie, so I'm assuming it's true, means right from Apple's mouth. We said that nothing is upgradable, meaning like if you were to open it up yourself, you're voiding your warranty or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But apparently you can bring it to Apple and they'll upgrade it. So as far as I'm concerned, I mean, as Marco pointed out, I think, and tweet replies to this, like, then you have to pay Apple's prices for RAM, which is ridiculous. But at the very least, it shows Apple not entirely closing the door. I wonder if that also applies to, like, SSDs. Could you take it to Apple and say, please take out this SSD and I will pay your crazy price to have twice as big an SSD and you'll put it in there for me? But, I mean, I still think the best bet is to just buy it how you want it configured, because all these upgrade options seem like they're expensive. But, you know, this is, I guess this is official from Apple. If they're going to do the upgrade, then at least that's one option available to you if you don't mind the cost.
Yeah, and there are also third-party Apple authorized service centers, so maybe you could get them to do it for you with third-party RAM that would be cheaper, but that's a big maybe, and it probably wouldn't be that much cheaper, relatively speaking. And then if you ever had to send it back into Apple, you know they're going to see that, and they're going to, you know, make you remove it or have a problem with it or something before they'd service the machine or something. So, like, it's like having all the downsides of having third-party RAM in your Mac that have been forever of, you know, trouble with Apple service sometimes and everything else. You know, everyone's going to blame that for any problems you have. But with the added complexity that you really can't get to it yourself to swap it in and out, and it probably won't be that much cheaper. So I feel like there's basically two reasons why most people want upgradable RAM in a Mac. Reason number one, which is probably by far the most common, is to save money from Apple's somewhat inflated costs and get cheaper RAM from somebody else. Reason number two is to buy it with one amount of RAM that you can, like, afford today, and then in a few years, increase the amount of RAM to extend its useful lifetime. And by that point, you will probably have more money and also the RAM will be cheaper. This seems to maybe solve the second one, but it almost certainly won't solve the first one. And I feel like the first one is probably the more common case among people who would be following this kind of news and making this kind of comment. So while it is nice that the RAM is upgradable by somebody, the fact that it's not really upgradable by you is, it might as well be not upgradable. Like, I'm with John. I would strongly suggest that you order it with the amount of RAM that you will want for the long haul, if at all possible.
iMac Pro input devices. I thought we had talked about this on the show very briefly, but you can get both the blacked out Magic Mouse and a blacked out trackpad, and it's something like $150 for both or thereabouts. I don't remember exactly how much.
The configurator wasn't up when we were recording the show, but we speculated, like, oh, do you have to buy two iMacs to get both of them? Because the Apple gave the reviewers both input devices, which seemed weird if that's not a thing that you can buy, but it totally is a thing you can buy.
Yeah, and I personally don't have any particular interest in the trackpad. I know it works for a lot of people. It's not really my cup of tea. But if I were to order an iMac Pro, which sitting here now, I am not currently planning on, there is zero chance that I would not get both devices, because even if I didn't end up using either the mouse or the trackpad, you know that you'll be able to sell that thing for $1 billion online.
Declan's college fund where you sell a black trackpad.
You're absolutely right. Unless there's some sort of, like, software, like DRM, for lack of a better phrase, that prevents them from working with anything but an iMac Pro, which would be ridiculous.
Yeah, the DRM is that it would clash and offend your sensibilities.
Well, fair point. I don't know. I wonder genuinely, once these start showing up, how much the keyboard... How much do you think? Let's start with Marco. How much do you think a keyboard... What is it? The Magic Extended Keyboard, whatever it's called. That and either pointing device. Doesn't matter which one. Just one pointing device. How much do you think that combination will go for on, like, eBay or equivalent?
I'm guessing it goes for a little above what they would cost at retail. I don't think it's going to be a crazy amount. And if it is a crazy amount, it's going to be only very briefly once they are in people's hands. I don't think this is going to be as big of a deal. Like, because these are already not cheap, right? They're already, like, the trackpad's about $160 by itself. Something like, if you like buy it at retail, and the keyboard's, I don't know how much the keyboard is, but, you know, and the mouse is $100, I think, or $80. And so, like, yeah, maybe for the $160 trackpad, you might get $200. You know, maybe in the first week, you might get $250. But I wouldn't expect it to be, you know, a bigger difference than that.
I would think it would be more.
I agree. I don't think it's going to be a big premium. I was going to say, like, a $50 premium for the first week and then settling down after that, especially when people find out that the keyboard bends. We got some, I didn't put it in fault, but we did get a bunch of feedback about that from people who had bent keyboards. And some people actually did say that, as far as they're aware, they got it and it was fine out of the box and they used it for several months, and eventually the middle touches when it didn't used to. and it, to the point where it starts to like spin, you know. I don't know if that's from the force of typing or from like heat or something, but you know, like when if the contact point becomes the middle and the sides start to lift up and it can sort of start rotating itself, that's no good.
That's super weird. I mean, if it's happening, it's happening, but that's super weird. Finally, people wrote in and pointed out to us that we missed talking about something, but I'm pretty sure we missed it because it didn't happen until after we recorded. And that is that the Mac Pro, not the iMac Pro, but the Mac Pro will be quote unquote upgradable. And so this is from an Apple press release. It reads, in addition to the new iMac Pro, Apple is working on a completely redesigned next-generation Mac Pro, architected for Pro customers who need the highest performance, high-throughput system, and a modular, upgradable design, as well as a new high-end Pro display. Now, this isn't really news, I don't believe, but it is Apple saying yet, you know, one more time, no, really, everybody, this is a thing, or, well, will be a thing, maybe, one day. And it should hopefully solve a lot of the problems that you guys justify. Well, I shouldn't say you two, but in general, people were complaining about. And that is upgradability. So, Marco, thoughts on that?
No, I mean, this was pretty much my fault. Like, you know, we recorded and I had said, like, you know, be careful to, you know, tame your expectations in upgradability, because I thought all Apple had said before that point was that it would be modular, not necessarily upgradable. But then they released this press release with the iMac Pro, which I think was actually earlier that day, and we just didn't see it, that says literally a modular upgradable design is coming with the Mac Pro.
You can bring your pessimism back and say that just the RAM will be upgradable. There's always room for worry.
Right. And also, you know, it might be a situation like what I was just describing with the iMac Pro RAM, which is like, who can upgrade it? Is only Apple going to be able to upgrade it? Also, what upgrades will work in it? Will you be able to put in any GPU? Probably not. Will you be able to put in any RAM? Probably not. You know, any disk modules? Probably not. Like, you know, there's going to be limits on what you can put in it. But there always were. There were, but the limits have increased over time with like the Mac Pro towers and everything. Also, just technology has moved on. Like, you know, if you're talking about wanting, for instance, like the old ones were very good about disk expansion. But that was also before SSDs, really. Like, you know, the SSD revolution started right at the end of the Mac Pro Tower era, really. And so you could put SSDs into the Mac Pro Tower, but it was not designed for them up front. Like, it was kind of a hack to get them in there if they weren't PCI cards, and even then those were kind of a hack. Everything was about 3.5-inch disks and optical drives. And these days, if you design that, you can argue, like, well, it probably shouldn't include a 3.5-inch disk bay at all, because high-end customers probably are not using a lot of internal 3.5-inch disks anymore. So, you know, like, there's a lot has changed since the era of the upgradable tower, and you could even argue for performance reasons. Like, you wouldn't want a whole bunch of like just serial ATA bays in there, because high-end SSDs are all using direct attached methods now, like directly attached to the PCI bus and things like NVMe and stuff like that. So, like, there's not a lot of upgradability that pro customers who are going to be buying the Mac Pro are actually going to want beyond, I think, RAM, disk space, but not necessarily like a large number of physical disks. And probably the number one is GPU upgrades.
Ding, ding, ding.
I don't know whether they're going to deliver that, but I think GPU and RAM are the big ones, and disk is kind of a secondary one.
I think disk they can get away with, especially if they have a way for you to, you know, like they can have the super high-speed storage, but then some standard for some slower bulk storage. But anyway, GPU is the big one. That's what we talked about last time. GPUs keep getting faster because you can make them faster by just adding more transistors. You can't do that with CPUs. You haven't been able to for a decade or more. And so it's so important to be able to do that, you know, even if Apple won't, that you can do it. That's why, you know, we talked about the GPUs last time, but more people and sending more links to people showing how a cruddy old cheese grater can beat the iMac Pro and all sorts of benchmarks if you just take a faster GPU and throw it in there. And this is an ancient cheese grater. Like, how do these new GPUs even work in there? Because it's just PCI Express, right? And it's just a standard card slot. And how does the old Mac support it? It supports it because the iMac Pro supports it, and Apple just made generic drivers for it. And that Apple, that's not an embarrassment for Apple, but it's like Apple wants in on that action too. Hey, we'll make a thing where you can put a new GPU in, and people want that machine because, like, you know, extending the life of the machine. If you buy this, the super expensive system that is upgradable, part of what you're paying for, and we build into the price in some way, is that this machine can last you a long time if you're doing GPU intensive work. After a year or two of use, you don't need to throw the machine out. You can just take the GPU out and put in one that's way faster for a couple hundred bucks and a new life for your machine. That's what we all want. That's the future liberals want.
We are sponsored this week by Aftershocks Bone Conduction Headphones. Go to atp.aftershocks.com to learn more. Aftershocks headphones work by bone conduction. This means small transducers rest in front of your ears, not inside or around them like most headphones, and they send tiny vibrations that you can't even feel through your cheekbones directly to your inner ear, which bypasses the outside of your ears completely. So unlike every other kind of headphone, bone conduction leaves your ears completely open with nothing in them. So, for example, this helps in comfort reasons. If you can't wear earbuds or in-ear monitors without pain, like I can't, this doesn't have that problem because there's nothing in your ear. They're also really great for exercising and hot weather because there's nothing covering your ear, so it doesn't get you all sweaty. And for exercising, it's even better because, or if it starts raining, because they are IP55 certified for water resistance. And the biggest thing about these headphones, the biggest thing that I think decides whether they're right for you or not, is because nothing is blocking your ears at all, you hear all the sound from the world around you, including what you're listening to. So in loud surroundings, this isn't so good, but they are awesome if you want to listen to a podcast or take a phone call while doing something like walking outside, where you really need to hear the world around you for your own safety. They're also great for practical reasons, like if you want to hear the world around you, whether it's your home or your office or anything else, and you want to hear, like, if someone knocks on the door, you want to know about it. Or say your kid is sleeping upstairs, they wake up, you want to know about that. With Aftershocks, you hear what's in the world around you as well as what you're listening to. Aftershocks has two great models that I recommend, the Trex Titanium and the Trex Air. They're both fantastic. The Air is the newer of the two. I spent a number of months with each of them, and you really can't go wrong. The battery life is fantastic on both of them. They're both very comfortable, very lightweight. The Air is a little bit better for comfort and weight. The Titanium fits in a pocket better. So either way, you can't go wrong. They're both wonderful. So check it out today. Go to atp.aftershocks.com to get a good deal on a nice pair of Aftershocks Trex Titanium or Trex Air. Once again, atp.aftershocks.com. Thank you so much to Aftershocks for sponsoring our show.
As a final note of follow-up, did we order anything? I will start and say I have not, which I think I said a moment ago. I still don't think I will, although if I ever see one in an Apple store, I'm going to really have some tough thoughts because I've seen this thing at WWDC and it is pretty. But it's rare that I do anything on my iMac that I have today that I feel like is truly and utterly constrained by something an iMac Pro would fix. John, did you order an iMac Pro? It's certainly you must have since this is the thing you've been waiting for years, is it not?
I took a while for me to figure out what you're even talking about. Like, what do you mean, what did we order? you were never going to order one, and I was never going to order one, and Marco was always going to order one, so no, I didn't buy anything.
So Marco, tell us about your configuration since we all know you did order one.
I think I ordered one.
What?
I ordered through the business rep, but I haven't gotten the order confirmation email, and my card has not been charged, and it's been 4 days.
Sometimes Marco blacks out when he buys things. He just wakes up and sees boxes at his front step, and it's like, it's inexplicable.
I'm not entirely sure whether my order has actually been placed or whether it fell on the floor because that was a very busy day for them or something. I have to follow up.
Okay, so if you ordered one, what build, what are the highlights of what you think you ordered?
Like, if I did it. all right, 10-core. To put this in context, the reason I ordered this computer is that Tiff wants it in 6 months. And so she wants me to buy this now so that way when the Mac Pro comes out, I upgrade to that and I give her this. So I basically configured it for Tiff, which means that I got the really big SSD. That was the big splurge. The 10-core... 64 gigs of RAM, not 128, because, I mean, my current...
Wait, what's the really big SSD? The 4 gig?
The 4 terabyte,
one?
Yeah.
What is she... For photos and stuff? What does she got mostly?
Photos and stuff, mostly, and a couple of video stuff around, too, because, like, you know, dealing with the photos and processing them into video sometimes, and...
What does she have? Like, how much stuff does she have now? Like, does she have more than 4 terabyte total storage? Like, are you buying her a computer that's, like, twice as big as the one she has now in terms of primary storage, or is it about the same size?
When we bought the 2014s that we have now, we maxed it out, but at the time, that was 1 terabyte. So it's 1 terabyte internal, and she's had this 4 terabyte external Thunderbolt RAID array that literally is 4 1 terabyte SSDs in RAID 0 Don't worry, it's very much backed up to various places. But that is now that's now been operating constantly for 3 years in this little enclosure with this dumb little fan. I don't know how long that's going to last. I'd rather not depend on it for too much longer. If any of those go bad, the last thing I'm going to want to do is buy a new 1 terabyte SSD in 2017. Kind of preparing for that to go away. Also, I just hate having another box and fan and this hot thing. All the Thunderbolt stuff runs really hot. Like all the controller chips that are in the devices, they run like red hot. That's why it needs this giant fan. It's not for the SSDs. Yeah, basically replacing that, simplifying her setup and making it better. So that's why I did that. And again, I was also kind of afraid because I'm like, you know, I can probably never upgrade these, or at least I won't want to upgrade them because whatever will be involved and whatever it will cost will probably be crazy. Yeah, 4 terabyte, and that was a lot of money. I'm not going to try to candy coat that. That was ridiculous. But you know, the rest, kind of a down the middle configuration: the low end GPU, the middle RAM amount, and the middle CPU, I guess.
How did TIFF approve the low end GPU?
Oh, interesting question.
So if you do the research on the 56 versus the 64, it's not that different. Like it seems like for what we do, I don't think anything we do, you would notice the difference at all. Because, you know, things like Photoshop and Lightroom, they do use the GPU, but not for a huge amount of stuff, and they don't use it very hard in the way that we use these apps. Additionally, you're probably thinking, what about gaming? But mm-hmm. even for A, most games she plays are not on the computer. B, it's still going to be a massive upgrade from what we have. And C, I don't think the gaming performance difference is going to be that big between those two.
We'll see.
Yeah, I'm surprised. So, I'm anxious to hear about this if and when it comes in, if and when you even ordered it, whether yeah. or not that was a fever dream. We'll see.
If I haven't ordered it, do you want me to make any edits when I resubmit the order?
Actually, I think John does. It sounds reasonable to me.
I would get a big GPU because it's not that much more, right? It's like a couple $100 more.
I think it's like 600 more. It's
600 more? Ugh, that's steep.
I elected to spend most of the craziness on the disc because we'll actually use that.
That's doing the thing where when you're buying a car and it's so expensive that $150 for floor mat seems like nothing, and you forget that $150 yeah, is the same size whether you compare it to $30,000 or you compare it to $10. It's always $150. It doesn't change size, but you feel like it does. So I could use that to persuade you. Given how much you paid for the SSD, $600 for a better GPU is nothing. It's like floor mats.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
$600 is way too much for the GPU speed upgrade, but what you paid for the 4 terabyte is also way too much. So, you know, I don't know where to go from here. Anyway, talk to Tiff, see what she thinks.
I agree.
All right, shall we do some Ask ATP?
Let's do it.
So I try to discourage emailed submissions because that encourages a lack of brevity. However, every once in a while, one sneaks through that I really like. And you added this to the show notes only because you beat me to it. And this is J.D. Lewin writes, I'm looking to dip my toe into the quote-unquote high-quality Headphone Plus DAC, digital analog converter, market, which led me to read some of Marco's older blog posts. At the moment, the Behr Dynamic DT880s, which I'm pretty sure is what I have on my head right now.
770s.
Darn it. I can be had for under $200. and a Fula? I don't even know how to
pronounce it. Fula.
Thank you. Two for $90. This seems to be an affordable way into dangerous waters. My question is about source material. Will this setup be wasted on the AAC files delivered through Apple Music, Spotify, etc.? So, Marco, take it away.
Yeah. So to answer the actual question of whether decent headphones will be wasted on playing AAC files from Apple Music and Spotify, no, definitely not. There is a point where some people claim that they can hear differences between AAC / MP3 / other lossy compressed formats and lossless music.
Excuse me.
Yeah. See also high sample rates higher than 44.1, you know, bit rates above 24 bit, etc. We talked about this before, but you know, basically, I'm not a believer in that being noticeable by most people. I'm not sure it's noticeable by any people, but at least the few like blind tests that have been done seem to support that it really is not noticeable by almost anybody. So, whereas the difference in headphones, like or speakers, like the difference in the actual transducers that are producing the music for you, that can be huge differences in very noticeable ways. So when you're looking for, like, you know, places to spend money if you want to get a good upgrade, a good bang for your buck, spend that money on the headphones or the speakers and not on, like, the amps and the DACs and the fancy source material and the high bit rate everything. Like, you will notice the headphones. You will not notice the DAC, and you will not notice the source material being, you know, good or bad, because unless it's encoded at very low bit rates, like a 128K MP3 or, you know, like about the same AAC, like as long as it's higher than that, basically, you're probably not going to notice it. And all the services now, they all offer high quality streaming if you have enough bandwidth that is high enough that you're not going to notice it. So don't worry about that. On the headphone topic itself, the Beyerdynamic DT880 is a very old headphone, but still a very, very good one. And if it can be had for under $200, that's a great deal. There's a huge headphone revolution happening over the last few years. Lots and lots of amazing headphones are coming out, and a lot of formerly fairly premium ones are being pushed down market. That is one of them. I highly suggest, if you are a fan of treble in music, in like if you like the kind of like crispness that turning up the treble a little bit offers you in music, if it doesn't sound harsh to you, Beyerdynamic is a great company to look at. Their headphones tend to be a little treble heavy, but if you like that, they are wonderful. They are also incredibly comfortable. The downside is that the 880, like almost any good and especially good and expensive headphone, has an open back to the ear cups. So that means, if you've never used this before, you're basically, the drivers are kind of suspended in open air. The backs of the headphones are just like screens. They're not solid material. And so an annoying tinny version of what you're listening to plays out to the room around you. And they don't isolate you very well from outside sounds. So this is really a terrible setup. It's a terrible thing to use open headphones if you are in either a loud environment, like walking around a city, or if you are sharing an office with anybody, because your music will be really annoyingly tinny and weird sounding to anyone else in the office. They will hate you if you play headphones in that way. But if you have like your own quiet space where there's not other people around to annoy, open headphones are by far the best sound you can get for the money. It's not even close. And there's basically three points that you need to know about in this market. On the very low end, you have the Grado SR60. Sounds amazing, costs like $60 or $70, but is pretty uncomfortable. Then you have the Beyerdynamic DT880, which is the one that JD is asking about here. They are great. Tiff uses a pair at her desk still. They're wonderful, around $200. Very, very comfortable. Everything about them is great, except they have that open back, which is, you know, impractical in certain contexts. And then also, if you don't like very strong treble, you won't like either of those options. If you like a more what they call laid-back sound, where they kind of like roll off the treble, it's very much like younger people tend to like this a little bit more, because it kind of goes into like the soft is loud musical aesthetic that has been taken over recently in like emo music and stuff and whatever else that I'm probably mangling the terminology for. If you like that, if you don't like a lot of treble and you like it to be very soft and like, you know, gentle on your ears, the Sennheiser HD650 used to be $600. And in recent years, they've done a bunch of like special things where they're cutting the price of that, or they're doing special editions with mass drop, but it's still basically the HD650. That is an amazing headphone. It's old and it looks kind of weird. It has like speckled plastic. It's a very ugly thing, but it's like, it's an amazing sounding headphone if you can get it for below $300. And if you don't like that strong treble that the Beyerdynamic will give you. So basically, those are my recommendations. Ignore the source material quality. Just get whatever you get. Don't be upset. It's wonderful. It'll be good enough. And if you want to spend $60, like, and you like treble and you don't like comfort, get the Grado SR60. if you want comfort and still like treble, the DT880. And if you don't like treble and you can spend like $300-ish range, the Sennheiser HD650. And on the DAC side, all of those can be driven perfectly fine from the headphone jack in any Mac, desktop, or laptop. The phone, you won't get a lot of volume out of if you try to push it too high. But you don't need an external DAC for any of those headphones. You might get a little bit better performance and volume, and maybe at the highest volumes, maybe a little bit better bass. Especially the HD650 is the least efficient of all those that I just mentioned, so that's the one that most would need one. But you're pretty much fine without that. If you just want to start, just get a really nice pair of headphones that can work with the built-in headphone jack in your Mac, which almost everything can.
You know, I'd just like to say I agree with pretty much everything you said. I don't know about specific recommendations of headphones. I haven't bought headphones in a long time outside of my AirPods. But I wanted to, and I think I've done this every time you brought it up, I wanted to concur with you about open headphones. I have an ancient pair of Sennheisers. I don't even remember what model they are. They're so damn ancient.
I think they're a 598, maybe?
Something like that. I mean, they're like easily 10 years old at this point. And I can dig up what they are. It doesn't really matter. But suffice to say, I have an ancient pair of Sennheiser open air headphones, and they are phenomenal. They are truly, truly great. It is terrible to be within 30 feet of me when I'm listening to them,
exactly.
but they are really, really good. And I also wanted to agree with you about the quality of the source material. That you can go flack if you want to be one of those kind of nerds. But again, Marco was absolutely right that the best thing to do is change your headphones. I will, however, say if you can stand in ear earbuds, earphones, whatever the
in your monitors,
version. Thank you. Yeah. Well, not even the custom mold ones. I'm just talking about like a really, really fancy pair of in-ear headphones. I think they're a lot more finicky. I don't think they're really worth it, but I have a really fancy pair of now very discontinued Ultimate Ears in-ear headphone things. And they are, when they're seated properly, they're the best headphones I have. But to be fair, to get them seated 100% properly is a real pain in the butt. So I still think Marco's right that doing something, a traditional headphone, preferably open air, is a better choice. But if you have ears that are conducive to in-ear things, or are willing to spend the money to get your ears poured and, you know, get custom molds made to get IEMs like Marco just brought up, that is probably the money no object, you know, effort no object, best and most effective way to get good headphones, in my personal opinion. But a lot of people don't really agree with that. Hello, Marco. And other people don't want to spend that money and
Hello,
or
John.
Don't want to be bothered. Hello, both of us.
Yeah.
So it's not the best answer unless you're really, really going deep into this world. But it's worth at least mentioning. All right. Jeremy Nachman writes, I've never had much interest in cars personally, but I have a 9-year-old who seems to have an interest. Do you have any car magazine recommendations that kids would enjoy? Doesn't necessarily need to be one targeting a kid's audience. When I was growing up and I was about this age, I used to love reading Car and Driver, and I don't pay attention to print magazines very much anymore. And I know, John, you do. So I'm going to turn it over to you in a second. But last I saw, Car and Driver was still pretty good. Motor Trend was okay. You can also get a lot of really good stuff on YouTube. And that's not even like me trying to plug myself. Although, hey, Casey on Cars is a new series you might want to look at. So here I am plugging myself. But no, like the Motor Trend stuff that's on YouTube is actually very, very good and very digestible and not too bro-y, generally speaking. There's plenty of car stuff on YouTube that is very bro-y and I wouldn't necessarily recommend for a 9-year-old. But the Motor Trend stuff is good in terms of magazines, Car and Driver. John, additional thoughts?
Yeah, the kid angle on this is what makes it difficult, because I watch a lot of car stuff on YouTube, and I have in the past subscribed to, I think, every straight car magazine, not like, you know, truck magazines or, you know, hot rod magazines or more specialty type of stuff, which may be what your kid ends up getting into. But for car magazines, Car and Driver is still my gold standard. But the reason I have trouble recommending this for a kid is because like when you think of car magazines, like in the worst case scenario, you're thinking of like some hot rod magazine where every single month there's a girl in a bikini sitting on the roof of a car. And you're like, oh, I'm not going to buy those for my kids, because that's, you know, I don't want to spread that kind of message about how this stuff works. But here's the problem with even Car and Driver, which I think has some of the best car writing and has for many years now. It is relentlessly, unconsciously sexist. Like, it is in every pore of that magazine. And you think, well, but there's no girls in bikinis on the cover. Like, it's fine, right? It's not, though. Like, every article is written assuming that the person reading it is a man. Like, every joke, every gag, every cover image, so much so that they don't even know they're doing it. They don't even think that there could possibly be another joke. They don't make any attempt, like, and then there's some right-wing politics that's thrown in there, but I think that's less harmful because it's, you know, mixed up with everything else. So I have trouble recommending that young people start their life in cars reading a magazine that assumes the only people who will ever be into cars are men, because that's not healthy for anybody involved. So I would say that YouTube has a higher chance of being sort of more welcoming, at least the YouTube channels I've seen. There are many things to not recommend them, and there are, of course, you know, YouTube channels with terrible bro-y people saying terrible bro-y things. What else is new? It's the internet. But A, I think kids are more likely to get into that than, you know, paper magazines, which, you know, come on, who reads those? And B, I think you might have a better chance of steering your kid towards a more inclusive YouTube channel. Because honestly, I don't know of any magazines that aren't. In fact, the Car and Driver is probably the best one. Automobile is fairly good too, but just all those car magazines just assume you are a guy reading a car magazine, and they half the time they don't even know they're assuming it. And it's not a good look, and it's not something that I would recommend a young person get into, because why perpetuate that?
Let me just put out a call that if you are listening to this and you know of a YouTube channel hosted by a woman that's really good, that's about cars, or know an author that's, you know, either a blogger or, you know, a particular author to look at any of these car magazines that's a woman, I would love to know that, because I certainly only hear dudes of various broiness talking about cars. I'd love to hear, you know, a different perspective on that. So, or maybe not even a woman, just a different perspective. I mean, define that however you'd like, but I'd love to hear it. So feel free to tweet at me and let me know.
And by the way, Jeremy didn't say whether his kid was girl or boy, and I don't think it matters. Like, you shouldn't, if your kid is like a little boy who's super into cars, he shouldn't be reading a magazine that assumes everybody who's reading it is a dude either. Like, that's, it has nothing to do with the gender of the child or anything like that. It's just, like, what I'm getting at is print is old, and it is mostly dominated by old people with old opinions, and even as new writers have come in, and I think I made a tweet a couple of years ago to the effect that you could see the changeover in the writing staff of Car and Driver when they started making jokes in the captions or their images that reference things like Star Trek, where you wouldn't have seen that when like Brock Yates was still writing or whatever. Like, there is a changing of the guard, but it's still the boys club, and it there's no reason it should be. There's nothing gendered about cars, right? So that's disappointing. And YouTube, I feel like, is slightly better. It's also worse, like, you know, the equivalent of the Bikini Girls on the Hoods, those YouTube channels totally exist too, right? So, you know, the internet is a big place, so be careful.
All right. And finally, from Jeffisu, ECC RAM seems to make sense for high stakes contexts like finance, space, like space travel, etc. What practical effects do you expect it to have on a Mac? Have you ever noticed a flip bit on your machine? Do you just find it cool as a nerd and or want it for peace of mind? So, John, can you kind of do a recap for us on what ECC RAM is, why this is relevant now, and then answer the question.
I think we did that on a couple past shows. We had debates about how important this is. So ECC stands for error correcting, where if they're, you know, they send the information from RAM, but they also have a bit to check whether the information you're getting is accurately represented. You think of it as like a parody bit or whatever, but I think it's more complicated than that these days. But anyway, usually they have the bit to recover, the ability to recover from small errors, like a one-bit error. They can correct that on the fly because they know which bit is off and what it should be instead. And so, you know, what would have been some bad data coming out of RAM gets corrected to the right data. Why would bad data come out of RAM? That's the question about ECC RAM. What errors are you correcting? Who cares if you have error correcting ability in your RAM chips? RAM chips don't make any errors. They're solid state components. Everything is perfect about them, right? Unfortunately, everything in the world of digital is under the covers analog until you get down to the quantum level, but we're not going to get into that.
So you got to have limits somewhere.
Yeah. So the question is, how often do these errors come up? And the last time we talked about this, we cited a bunch of studies. We'll put two links into the show notes about two semi-recent ones. One of them was a 2009 study that was supposedly saying that the error rates in RAM were much higher than had previously been measured. Something like 25 to 70,000 errors per billion device hours per megabit with errors on more than 8% of DIMMs. And there's an IBM study in the 90s looking at like the causes of this, like, you know, radiation from space, essentially flipping your bits, assuming you're not in something that is shielded from cosmic rays, producing one error per 256 megabytes of RAM per month. And, you know, you can tell it's from the 90s because they're talking about so one error per 256 megabytes of RAM per month. That's not a small number if we have 4 gigs of RAM, right? Or 16 gigs or whatever you have. Errors happen. Now, the question is, all right, so who cares a bit is flipped? What does that manifest in some way? If you got unlucky, it could take your whole computer down. But chances are good, nothing will happen because that bit didn't matter. Like, there are so many bits that just don't matter. Not even that it gets corrupted and ends up in the file system. Maybe that bit just didn't matter at all. Or, you know, it changed something. It changed the color of a pixel in a way that you couldn't detect. Or it just ended up in some garbage data at the end of... at the end of some buffer that never got reached. Like, maybe it just doesn't matter. It came out of RAM and it got overwritten with something else. But every once in a while, it does matter. And the reason people use ECC is because they think, you know, that for the small incremental cost of having ECC RAM, maybe it saves you for computers that run a really long time and uptime is important and correctness is important. This is the best we have to get a little bit more safety for not that much more cost. And that's why servers use it, and that's why fancy high-end desktops with server hardware use it. And I think a lot of it for nerds like us is like, well, it doesn't cost that much more, and it makes it slightly more reliable, so let's do it. But, you know, it's not like a light comes on when it tells you it just saved you from something, because kind of like the big sky theory in aviation, the big RAM theory is... the chances of one of those bit flips actually affecting something you do in a way that you notice is actually pretty low, but it just, you know, it does make us feel better.
So the answer is no, there's no reason, basically.
No, I mean, the reason is that it does improve things and it doesn't cost that much more. If it was seven times the cost, it would be ridiculous, but it's just a little bit more. And so you're like, yeah, why not? Why not do that for a little bit more?
Also, and I this could just be terrible anecdata, you know, but just anecdotally, my Mac Pros have been the most stable, solid machines I've owned. And I've used laptops full time, I've used an iMac full time, and I've used Mac Pros full time. And it's very, very different. The Mac Pros were always the most stable machines by far.
Well, you didn't keep the trash cans long enough for your GPUs to overheat, so
I didn't use the GPUs heavily enough.
Yeah.
During the 8 or 9 months I had one, it was rock solid. We are sponsored this week by Backblaze, unlimited cloud backup for Macs and PCs for just $5 a month. Visit backblaze.com/ATP to get a 15-day free trial. You need online backup, because if you are only backed up to, say, a hard drive next to your computer in your office or your house, you aren't protected from things like fire, floods, theft, power surges, or just human errors that could accidentally wipe the data on that hard drive or damage that hard drive in addition to the one in your computer. With Cloud Backup, you have a wonderful fail-safe option that can cover all sorts of different risks that a local backup can't. You also have very convenient features. So, for instance, if you have a Cloud Backup, you can do things like restore a file from your home computer onto a laptop when you're on vacation. If you need to work on that file, you forgot to bring it with you. You can also do the same thing from their mobile app right onto your phone. So if you're on your phone and need to get a file from your home computer, you can just restore it with their app for iOS and Android right onto your phone. It's very, very convenient. If you need to do a whole system restore, if you lose all your data, you need to actually restore from the cloud, you can use their website to download it immediately, or you can have them overnight you a hard drive via FedEx. And if you return the hard drive back to them when you're done, you get a full refund. It's a win-win. Backblaze has restored over 20 billion files for their customers, and all of this is available for just $5 a month per computer. With unlimited space, unlimited bandwidth, unlimited usage, $5 a month per computer. That's it. There's no gimmicks. There's no add-ons. That's all there is. It's all you need to pay. It is wonderful. I've used it for years now, since before they were a sponsor. I pay for it like everyone else, and it is great. If you don't have cloud backup yet, I highly, highly urge you. You really should have cloud backup for your own safety. And if you're going to get cloud backup, I recommend Backblaze. It is the best one I've tried, and I've tried them all. So check it out today, backblaze.com/ATP. Start today, really. Backblaze.com/ATP for the best cloud backup service. $5 a month, unlimited space. Thank you so much to Backblaze for sponsoring our show.
I have questions about the iMac Pro / Mac Pro. As someone who used to know the ins and outs of what the current processors were and GPUs and things of that nature, like 20 years ago when I was building my own PCs, I have not kept up in a long time. And it seems like, and I might even get this backwards, so jump in and correct me, but it seems like everyone is really perturbed that the iMac Pro is only coming with an AMD graphics card. And apparently it's a bit like NVIDIA or bust in the graphics card department. Can one of you guys explain to me, like, A, do I even have that right? B, why? And C, then why isn't Apple offering NVIDIA cards, and why are they so committed to AMD? Or at least, what's your best guess, if nothing else? John, do you want to kind of talk me through this?
So the NVIDIA thing, we talked about this before, about who at various times in our life using computers has been the GPU performance king, you know, like starting from, I guess, the Voodoo 3D days on.
I remember those days. Well, those were good days.
3DFX, and, you know, anyway.
Did the Mac, I think we've talked about this months and months and months ago, but did the Mac ever have the thing where you had a little stubby VGA cable to connect the 2D card to the 3D card? Do you know what I'm talking about? I
was pretty sure it did not ever have anything like that.
No, the Mac never had gaming or VGA.
It did have VGA. There were Macs that had VGA.
You know exactly what I'm talking about, though, don't you, Marco? Like, you had one of these.
Yeah, it would connect to your 3DFX accelerator card.
Yeah.
Yep.
Those were the days. Sorry. Anyway, John, carry on, please.
So, you know, as the market is consolidated, it's settled down in the latter years as being ATI versus NVIDIA. And occasionally they would swap places of in what generation of card, you know, they would revise their architectures, and then they would have multiple cards, and you'd have overclock cards and stuff. And then they revise their architecture. Anyway, at various points, NVIDIA had the fastest, meaning like basically for games, like who can run insert hot 3D game here the fastest. Sometimes it was NVIDIA, sometimes it was AMD. If you looked at the swings, it seems that in the most recent years, NVIDIA has been on top more, but it really depends on the specific application. But for right now, NVIDIA is on top in a lot of markets. In games, I think they're on top because they make a lot of cards that make sacrifices in precision for the purposes of performance. And very often, ATI, which is now AMD, would tell you, yeah, that's fine, but if you want to do real serious work with, like, a program that requires higher precision, that AMD is better or whatever. But also because NVIDIA and AMD have chosen different platforms for compute on GPUs, and NVIDIA's one that they're... What is theirs?
CUDA.
CUDA, yeah. Is right now more popular. And so we had someone actually write into us about this. This is Daniel, who said, in addition to NVIDIA being faster, there's lots of software now that uses GPU acceleration, but only NVIDIA. So their application software written, it's accelerated for GPUs, but literally only accelerated by NVIDIA GPUs. The example gives us Redshift and Maya and 3D, new plugins for Nuke, like Eddy and GoGhost on the 2D side. So part of it is like just market success, that NVIDIA was able to convince software makers of these big expensive pro applications to write their software to only be accelerated by NVIDIA cards. So that, forget about who's faster, forget about who has better cards or whatever. If it literally won't work with AMD graphics cards, that's bad. Like, it'll, you know, but run in an accelerated mode. And then secondarily, if you're into games or lots of other applications, chances are that right now NVIDIA sells the absolute fastest card that will run whatever your GPU thing is the fastest. That's why we had that question a while back, was saying, if the Mac Pro doesn't support NVIDIA, is it a failure or whatever? I don't think it is, for the most part. And, you know, if you have to use one of these applications that is only accelerated by NVIDIA, chances are good you haven't had a Mac in a long time. Because for whatever reason, I'm not sure what the reason is, but for whatever reason, Macs have not shipped with NVIDIA GPUs, either standard or optional, for a long time now. So it's not as if people are out there using Macs with NVIDIA graphics card waiting to upgrade. All these people who are using these programs presumably are already using PCs. But anyway, that's why I think people are concerned about the NVIDIA situation, because part of the promise of the Mac Pro is it's a modular system and it's upgradable. But how upgradable is it really if you can only ever put in a new AMD graphics cards? I mean, that's great. Like, it lets you extend the life of the machine, like we said before, but there was a time that some Mac users may remember when you could buy a Mac, like the one sitting next to me right now, that could run cards from both of those manufacturers. And that time was good, and we would like that time to return.
Yeah, I think, I mean, some other angles to consider here. I mean, so first of all, the explanation of why we have not seen any new Macs with NVIDIA GPUs in something like 3 or 4 years is it possibly related to, there was a massive series of NVIDIA GPU failures in MacBook Pros we heard rumblings here and there from various uncredible sources that like there might be some kind of big political rift between Apple and NVIDIA from that time. But it does certainly seem like there is definitely like it is a choice that Apple is making not to ship NVIDIA GPUs in all of their computers since a few years ago. It is not just coincidence.
And on that issue, though, on it being a choice, which again I've heard as well, the weird part about it is that modern Apple especially has always been really enthusiastic about always having two suppliers for everything that it does. Like, you know, even just like, because if they get themselves in a situation where there's one, they get themselves into a Qualcomm situation, then they're just like, they need someone to play off of. But everything, the RAM, who's manufacturing their systems on a chip, like SSDs, screens, best case, Apple wants to have two sources, not just for redundancy, but so that you don't become under the thumb of one. Like, you can become under the thumb of Qualcomm. It's like, who else are you going to go to? No one else can make your radio chips. Ha, ha, ha. Like, so it would behoove Apple to go to both of them and play them off each other. Who knows? Maybe that's exactly what they're doing, and NVIDIA just keeps losing the contract. But from the outside, it just seems like they are now a single vendor source for their GPUs. And that can't be healthy. I mean, and maybe the long-term plan is Apple's just going to make its own GPUs because it's a core part of their business. And they kind of have been doing that on the portable side. What was it? Was this the first one that's all their own GPU with no Imagination Tech?
I believe so.
Yeah, but they haven't done that on the Mac, and they probably won't because for all the reasons that we've discussed before about investment in the Mac. But it just still seems weird to me that it's a much more natural fit for Apple's business practices to be supporting both, but they haven't recently.
Well, and I think there's a couple angles here. I mean, number one, like, you might be right, like AMD just might be winning all these bids because it certainly seems clear that Apple has a pretty good relationship with AMD. And for things like, if you look at the 2013 Trashcan Mac Pro, those were like total custom GPUs, like just for that AMD made at Apple's order. So like, there's clearly like a lot of a good relationship there where like AMD will probably make Apple pretty much whatever they ask for, which is, and the pricing that they give Apple appears to be pretty good. Like, if you look at the workstation GPU pricing that AMD charges, and then you look at what Apple gives you in like the stock configuration of the Mac Pro and the iMac Pro, it does seem like AMD is giving Apple a pretty good deal. So it could just be that. But there, you're right that Apple does have two suppliers for a lot of things. One of the big ones that they don't is Intel for their CPUs. And ironically, the winner of that bid otherwise would be AMD. but you know, maybe they have a similar relationship with AMD on the GPU side that they have with Intel on the CPU side, which is kind of this like, you know, assured exclusivity in exchange for their good relationship with AMD. And you know,
the difference is that Intel can give them the very best chips of that kind in the world, whereas AMD at various times cannot. And although this is also brings in a topic that kept getting pushed down in the show notes, but the several weeks ago or months ago deal where Intel is bundling AMD GPUs and sort of like not on the same die, but like in the same package.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they're, and so that's an interesting synergy between Apple's two favored vendors. And you know, Intel, like, it makes some sense to me that Apple's going with Intel. That if AMD, you know, there's that relationship, and there's the, you know, IBM, even more so than AMD, has proven that they will make one-off custom chips for Apple, like in the MacBook Air back in the old days. And there's a lot of speculation that the reason Intel put so much work into its internal GPUs with the embedded DRAM and all that stuff is because that's what Apple wanted them to do. So I'm sure Apple likes your relationship where they have a big say in what products get generated. And honestly, the competitor to Intel is not particularly competitive. And we get back to, again, Apple probably wants to just make its own chips if it ever comes to that. But the difference in that scenario is there is no software that only runs accelerated on AMD AMD CPUs, right? Like, it's not the NVIDIA situation where there's whole classes of software that are written to CUDA and that Intel doesn't support it or whatever.
And you know, overall, like, there is a huge difference in the results here because, you know, as you briefly alluded to, like, Intel, if you are Intel exclusive for your PC CPUs, you're fine because the vast majority of the time, Intel is the leader in that race, usually by a pretty big margin. AMD's CPU business has been second run basically since like the Pentium 4. Like, it had a good run there for a little while where it was king, but then it wasn't. So if it was the other way around, if Apple had this great relationship with AMD for the CPUs and would never used Intel CPUs, they'd have a pretty big problem. They just wouldn't be very competitive a lot of the time. And the problem is they now have that problem on the GPU side. Where on the GPU side, I think they do okay with power per watt, but they don't have the sheer performance edge that they would have if NVIDIA was their only supplier, or if they would use both like they used to. You know, it used to be that, like, you know, every generation of like a Mac or a MacBook Pro, like it they would like alternate between which vendor they were supplying, just whoever had like the most compelling one that they could get in enough volume or whatever else. Like, but by going seemingly AMD only for GPUs for at least the last few years, I think it is really starting to hurt them, especially at the high end. I've heard from so many people who see the news about the iMac Pro or the Mac Pro and just write it off as, sorry, we can't do that because it doesn't support CUDA. And the only thing that might be an escape valve here is external GPU support. I think with Thunderbolt 3 now supporting external GPU boxes, that might be their answer. Like, it might be like, we're going to keep using AMD for our main GPUs, but if you're a pro customer and you want a CUDA card for your work, maybe putting it in a Thunderbolt chassis is close enough.
Yeah, the benchmark still, especially for these applications that need this, like, that's where the bandwidth actually does come in. It doesn't come in games, probably. If you're just interested in games, you can probably get away with any GPU. But for all these fancy computational things that actually send a lot of data back and forth, Thunderbolt isn't, you know, it's not even close to the bandwidth of an internal card. I think Barefeet also has done benchmarks with that too. Like, you know, let's try MacBook Pro with any GPU versus the iMac Pro with its internal versus a good old cheese grater with some $900 NVIDIA graphic card shoved into this ancient internals from 2010 or 11. And the stupid cheese grater wins every time because it's got an internal GPU with more bandwidth than everybody else. And it's got the fastest, the latest card from NVIDIA. And so, like I said, when the person originally asked the question, would the Mac Pro be a failed product? I don't think so. I mean, it's silly that Apple won't support it if it's like some weird political reason or whatever. But whatever, you know, if you buy a computer with the fastest available GPU, next year it's not the fastest GPU anymore. And so if you just pretend every Mac Pro you're buying is already a year old, as long as you can either upgrade it so that every single year you can buy a faster GPU, or B, that Apple revises it, and so every year if you bought a new one, it has a faster GPU in it. Like, the worst situation is they put it out with a competitive, pretty fast GPU that may actually, by the way, be faster in your particular thing, because if you're not running games and you're not running a CUDA accelerated application, sometimes the AMD GPU is the fastest. It really depends on what you're doing. But the trick is, you need some way to stay on that performance path. You can't have the fastest one and then just never offer another GPU for 3 years and not have it be upgradable. So the people need some way to every year reap the benefits of the embarrassing parallelism of the graphics world. And that's what the Mac Pro has to deliver. If it can't deliver NVIDIA, that's a bummer for some people. But what it has to deliver is the ability to get back on the GPU train. You can put in the All Aboard screen from Crazy Train right here, Marco. All Aboard!
Oh, I was going to put on Back on the Train by Phish.
No, I do not approve of that. Crazy Train.
Every podcast needs a Viper Slap. We are brought to you this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. Now, many of our listeners, myself included, know how to make websites ourselves without using Squarespace. We know how to, like, get a server set up and put a CMS on there or build our own CMS from scratch. But then we also, if we're honest with ourselves, we know that never takes as fast as we want it to. And there's always additional overhead to managing it that we probably shouldn't need to worry about. Things like security updates and patches and backups and caching and keeping it up if we get, you know, a prominent link from somewhere and everything else. And the reality is, with Squarespace, you don't have to worry about any of that. And that's probably a better use of your time, is to just go to Squarespace, make your website for your next podcast or your next blog or your next portfolio or a store or just a website just for fun to show off what you like or what your business is. Make that website with Squarespace instead of doing it yourself through any other kind of means, because pretty much everything else, honestly, is not a good use of your time. You should be focused on your business or your project or your hobby instead of worrying about your web hosting. And Squarespace gives you that luxury. Squarespace sites look great. No matter what your skill level is, you can create a site that looks professionally designed and that works on all devices of any size. They take care of patching and backups and security and caching and everything. You don't have to worry about any of that. All you do is focus on your project. Let them worry about your website. Start your free trial site today at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up, make sure to use offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. I actually had a call with Apple PR last week about the iMac Pro after we recorded.
What?
Did you get a call, Casey? I didn't get a call.
I did not get a call. Well, of course I didn't get a call. I mean, come on. But
you sounded like the biggest iMac Pro fans, so they figured they would call Casey, you know.
Yeah, Casey has a review unit.
that would be the ultimate troll. Oh my god, would that be amazing? But no, I have received no calls of any sort. I am not special.
Well, anyway, they reached out to me and said they wanted to schedule a call. I was very pleasantly surprised, and so I prepared some questions, and I didn't really know what to expect, but it was really nice. It was really pretty open, pretty laid back. I mean, and to set the expectations a little bit, like sometimes people will get mad at like when John Gruber has his podcast where he'll occasionally have an Apple executive on, some people get mad that he doesn't ask certain questions, like things like, when's the next Mac Pro coming, because the reality is, like, Apple's not going to tell you about future products. It's kind of a waste of a question. Like, if you're only given a limited amount of time, it's a waste of time to ask them questions they are unlikely to answer or likely to give you the answer you want, asking about when future products are coming, or really asking anything about future products, is a waste of time. So I didn't. I'm sure someone's going to be mad and write in because of something I didn't ask. But that was generally, there might be things I just didn't think about, but generally there were a lot of things that I didn't ask because the real question, even if it wasn't phrased a certain way, you can tell the real question is really about a future product. So, for example, I wanted to ask about, why are there so many USB-A ports and a card reader on the back? But I knew, that's really a question about the MacBook Pro.
That was my question. You didn't ask that? That was going to be my first thing to ask you. You didn't ask my question?
I actually did kind of ask it, but I didn't get the response that was our pro customers hated the MacBook Pro. No, it wasn't like that. It was basically explaining, we offered the ports as many as we could for our pro customers, et cetera, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's that question, those type of questions, because you can't ask them about future things. You can only ask them about the product. So basically, that's the only way you're ever going to get anything, is to say, why does product that you're at, that we're talking about right now, have feature, right?
So right.
Why does that? You can't even say, why does the iMac Pro have USB-A ports and the MacBook Pro doesn't? You have to just say, I noticed there's a lot of USB-A ports in the back. Why are those there? Or why does it have them? And to give them the opportunity to give their canned PR answer. And if they don't have a canned PR answer because they thought no one would ever ask that, then they have to think on their feet and maybe you get a little bit of insight. But sometimes they'd be very forthcoming about, they could say there's some specific customers that we talked to that have really important USB-A peripherals. And we thought, you never know what they're going to say. And that's a way to get legit information out of it. You just have to know how to phrase it, not as, this computer doesn't have them, why does the iMac Pro have them? Because that's not going to put them in the right frame of mind to give you any good info.
Right, exactly. Anyway, it's very clear that they really are very heavily focused on developers for this machine. It wasn't immediately obvious when the PR first came out, on whatever day it was that all the embargoes lifted on the first week review units. It wasn't incredibly obvious then, because everything that came out first was all YouTubers. And so we all thought, myself included, wow, they just gave it to YouTubers. That's kind of, I guess that's understandable. But then as it turned out, later that day, we saw a bunch of tweets and blog posts, many of which were from developers. And it's very clear that they actually were reaching out to a lot of developers for this. And developers just aren't that good at being at minute one after an embargo and stuff like that. Because, developers are not, usually reviewers or journalists. So that's, it's kind of like trying to coordinate cats to all do something. Although I still believe that cats are all a hive mind and they're all the same cat, just different visions of the same cat.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, very strong focus on developers here. They really, you could tell that they worked with a lot of developers in development. They talked to a lot of developers. They clearly cared a lot about developer needs, because you know, a lot of these are going to sell to high-end developers. They're going to sell to, you know, just people like me who are willing to spend the money on a very, very fast machine for our app development. They're going to sell to, you know, VR developers, you know, hopefully, and you know, high-end developers, content creators, etc. So, like, they were very concerned about making sure that this was a good machine for developers. And I really respect that. And even though, you know, it's kind of, I'm a little bit biased in that because I'm a developer and this worked out for me because they wanted to talk to me. So obviously I'm a little bit biased, but I thought that was a really good angle. They seemed sincere about it. They seemed like they had really done their homework, done their diligence, and done their research. And for instance, like one of the things was that 10-core they find is the most ideal configuration for most developer workflows. And they know this because they actually did tests and, you know, worked with people and figured out what people do. And they were able to tell that, like, usually after about the 10-core mark, the you know, today's tools tend to not use many of the cores after that, or you're bottlenecked by other things like I/O. So that made total sense. One of the things I asked about, because, you know, last show we had a lot of discussion about the thermal design of the iMac Pro, and about the idea that they were downclocking the two base CPUs by like 10% or something at their base clocks. And we're kind of saying, like, you know, John had a lot of thoughts about it and kind of saying, like, you know, why drop down the performance to fit in the enclosure that nobody was asking you to fit it in? So I asked a lot about this, and they were pretty unwavering about that. They didn't, like, cram it in here unnecessarily. They tried to see if they could fit workstation components into this case, and they could. You know, they did a lot of redesigning of the thermals. So, like, because there is no 3.5-inch disk offered in the iMac Pro, that frees up a pretty large block of pretty premium space right in the middle. And, like, and you know, because 3.5-inch disks compared to the internals of an iMac are huge. And it certainly does seem like they have filled a lot of that space with, like, heatsink, basically. So, because it certainly has a massive heatsink apparatus back there from the pictures. So the impression I got from this question is that they didn't have to compromise to fit the workstation parts into this case. They designed it, it fit, and there seems to be headroom, which I'll get to in a little bit.
So what did they say about the downclocking? We had some feedback about that. So there's the base CPUs that you talked about, but there's also the GPUs, which I didn't know whether they were downclocking, and I speculated that maybe they'd be 90% downclocked, but someone emailed the show to say they're actually 83% downclock versus what they would be like if you took that same card and put it in a PC. And so, and also one other bit of feedback about downclocking, specifically the GPUs. Again, I don't know if the provenance of this information is sound or not, but someone emailed to suggest that AMD has been optimistic with the clock speeds and that really if you run them at the quote-unquote rated speed, that it shortens their life and Apple cares more about them so that they just buy, you know, they just always run them slightly downclocked anyway, just because if they don't, they'll have reliability problems. I don't know if that's trash can fallout or just total BS or just speculation or whatever. But anyway, all we know is the numbers we can look at. And apparently, if you buy this exact card from AMD and just on a regular card slot, the iMac is running them 83% slower, which is, you know, not insignificant. So when they say, can we fit it? Yes, they could fit it. But if you can fit it by downclocking and using slower speed things, did you really fit it, or did you have to compromise on something? Like, I feel like their answer to you was just rephrasing the question. Like, why did you fit everything inside the case? We wanted to see if we could fit everything inside. Yeah, but why? Why didn't, like, the real question is, why didn't you make a new case? And that the reason there is, like, well, we didn't want to spend that much money on it. It would be a lot of design time. We wouldn't, you know, like, there's other reasons that they're probably not going to tell you of why they didn't design a new case, because surely it is faster to market and cost them less money and less time and less everything to use the same external design. I was going to say they get to use the same VESA mounts, but they did change that part of the case. So I don't know. It's still slightly mysterious to me. But anyway, that from as far as we can tell, you take those same parts and put them in an ugly, boxy PC, and you can get them all to run at faster speeds or use higher bin parts.
Yeah, I mean, the GPU, I honestly don't have any qualifications to talk about GPUs. So I didn't ask really anything about them because I don't know anything about GPUs. But on the CPU part, as Gruber points out a lot, like, Apple doesn't usually lie. Like, you know, they'll spin things a certain way if they want to, but they don't usually outright lie. Like, usually if they tell you a straight out answer, that is the truth. So, and in this case, like, they were very clear that, like, they didn't need to change the case. And there's some thermal stuff that I'll get to in a few minutes that I think probably supports that theory, if it ends up being, you know, panning out that way. On the subject of the CPU downclocking, so I did some research before the call, and I discovered that it's only the 8 and 10 core that are downclocked from their, like, retail speeds, from the retail parts. The 14 and 18 are identical. They are all rated at the same TDP, so the same heat capacity of 140 watts. They all are the same. The 8 and 10 core chips are special chips that were made by Intel just for Apple's OEM use here. That's why they even have different model numbers. They have a B on the end, and they're, like, slightly different numbers than their counterparts. If you look, I'll link to the Wikipedia table that lists all the Skylake Xeons. So you can see, like, these are special chips that are only used in, you know, by Apple, and so far only in the iMac Pro. And their answer to that was basically, like, you know, they are the custom part from Intel, and that's just how the clock speed's binned out for these chips. One of the things they wanted to make sure of is that all of the processors that are available in the iMac Pro have the same AVX512 processing capacity. These are the new instructions that are, I think, new to these chips, or at least new to the current generation of Xeons. These are super high-end, like, vector instructions for certain types of math that can be very well optimized. Some of the Xeons that are in this family only have one compute unit. The high-end ones have two. Apple made sure that all of theirs have two. That being said, I looked up the specs for the corresponding parts that are slightly higher clocked, and they have two also. So I'm not entirely sure what that means right now. That could have been a later change in the release cycle for Intel, where they decided to put two on those, or they could have been referencing different parts they could have used but didn't. But the important thing that I got from the call is that they didn't see this as an artificial lowering of the clock speed. This is just how they were binned out for their custom part, and they made sure their custom parts all had the same AVX512 dual processing units. So,
what's custom about them besides the AVX stuff?
I don't know. I can ask them. I mean, you know, they're friendly. They'll probably answer an email if I ask them. So I think our concerns about the thermals are probably unwarranted, because what I heard from them, which confirms what I heard from other people who were at their demos or who have had review units so far, it sounds like there is a lot of thermal headroom. They had certain demos at these events that were running on loops all day long that were stressing all the CPU cores at, like, 60% or higher all the time, and that you couldn't even really hear the fan. And what I was told basically is that the way the thermals work out in this generation, that you can hammer the CPUs pretty hard and you probably won't hear the fan spin up. You will pretty much only hear it get loud if you're hammering the CPUs and the GPUs. And this actually is plausible to me, because this is actually not that different from how the Skylake laptops work. The Skylake Ivy Bridge? I already forget. So the current laptop generation, compared to the old one that I'm still holding on to, is way quieter under CPU load. It doesn't spin up for nearly as, you know, as long, you know, and you know, it cools down much faster and everything else. So given that these are the Xeons from the Skylake family, that actually, I think, makes sense. That's believable to me. And it does seem like they've designed this with a lot of thermal headroom. So for the moment, having not used one of these yet, having not owned one of these yet, it does sound like they are not concerned about thermals. And all the demo units and all the review units out there so far have shown pretty awesome thermal and noise performance. So far, it seems tentatively like it might be pretty awesome on the thermal and heat front. And therefore, that also supports their position that these aren't really downclocked for meaningful performance reasons.
Well, you keep excluding the GPU because you didn't want to talk about it, but it's more than half of the heat in here, and certainly half of the equation. Like, if this info from this is just from a listener, because I don't know the clock speeds of this GPU and stuff, but if these GPUs really are at 83% of the clock speed that if you were to buy the same card and put it in a PC and get the fastest one, Like, why would you choose to do that if you've got the thermal headroom? It doesn't, you know, especially if it's like literally the same part downclocked and not just binned differently for pricing thing. Like, I don't quite understand how that math works out. So it sounds like for the CPU, we have some good information on it. And certainly you've been doing things that stress the CPU and it seems like there's plenty of room. But kind of like in the trash can, if you happen to do something that uses them both at once, what does that do to things? Like, you know, why? The explanation for why the CPUs are down clocked is like, oh, that's just how they binned out. And maybe they had to be slower clocked because they've got the two AVX units and the normal ones of that size didn't. That kind of makes some kind of sense, right? But why on the other side of the case where the other fan is blowing into, you know, well, actually both fans are rolling through the same heat sink. But anyway, on the other side of the case where the GPU is, why if that stuff actually is clocked down, and by the way, if you know the exact clock speeds of like the GPUs, CPU and memory buses, please send it to the show. That doesn't match up with the idea that there's plenty of thermal headroom, because especially like on the high end part, why wouldn't you run those at their full speed?
Yeah, and honestly, I don't know whether it's run at full speed or not. I will say that, like, you know, nothing they said indicated that it couldn't handle stressing both the CPU and GPU, just that you'd be more likely to hear it.
Yeah, I don't know. And I would imagine the demos that they should actually did stress both of them. You know, we haven't been there for the demos, but I think the demos probably did stress both the GPU and the CPU. So maybe those are a good example. And, you know, and maybe, again, they traded the quiet for like, look, if we clock this at 83% of max speed, we can just be quiet all the time no matter what. And isn't that a better pro experience than allowing it to get noisy, you know, for this particular case, because maybe some people are using applications that are stressing both of them all the time, and it's not a great experience for the pro Mac whose fans you can't escape by putting it under the desk to be noisy. Like, I can come up with all sorts of reasons why they can explain this, because again, this is the compact pro machine. It's not the Mac Pro, right? But I don't know which of those explanations that I could come up on my own is the right one, if any.
You know, and maybe I think what, you know, what you just said about kind of like hitting like a constant load minimum heat performance kind of thing, that might be related to the way the CPUs are clocked, because I think it says something that these all have the same TDP. So like when driven fully, like at maximum, all the cores stressed, they will all cap out at the same heat output at all the core counts. However, only the bottom two chips had their base clocks reduced from the Intel retail parts. So maybe it really is like a heat and noise thing, because the way Turbo Boost works is, you know, with all modern Intel chips, like if it has thermal headroom, it will increase its clock speed until it hits a certain maximum that it won't go past, or until it starts getting too hot, or until like more cores get engaged, and then it starts to reduce the overall ceiling on them so that it keeps below that threshold. But it doesn't ever go below the base speed, and the turbo clock is reduced on those two that they've modified, the 8 and 10 core. They did reduce the Turbo Boost max speed as well. So I don't know what that means in this theory, but by reducing the base clock, it's still going to turbo up a lot when it's in use, but it's going to run at the reduced base clock speed when it's not doing heavy lifting, and so maybe that is primarily there for, you know, lower noise and heat when it's most of the time doing pretty light work.
So really, all of our, well, maybe not all, but a lot of our qualms from last episode may be a little premature.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the answer really is we don't really know yet until we really get these machines. Well, until I get this machine. You guys aren't getting it. But although, well, I'll get to that in a minute. But until we really get these machines, we really can't be incredibly sure about any of these things. I am hopeful now with, you know, after having this call and also having, you know, heard from the reviewers and the people who were at these events, it doesn't sound like there's reason to be concerned about the thermals yet. And that's pretty promising. I'm very happy to hear that, because that was my big concern going into this. It seems like there's a lot of headroom and that they didn't need to make the case bigger and make it full of holes like what John wanted. So we'll see if that actually pans out. But I think it's plausible. I asked a few more things, kind of like side notes here. On the T2, one thing I thought was very interesting is that it is indeed the SSD controller. Like, it is the disk controller. And in all of the configurations, not just the 4 terabyte one, it uses dual SSD modules, and it uses them in parallel for performance. And so even at the even if you get the terabyte, that's just using two 512s. And with the T2 controlling it, you know, it isn't abstracted to the OS as two disks the way if you just plug in like a two disk enclosure without any kind of RAID functionality, it shows up as two disks. It isn't like that. It shows up as one disk. The controller shows it as one device, but behind the scenes, it is actually using two in parallel. It's one of the reasons why they're so freaking fast.
We got anonymous feedback about that, by the way, about the dual module thing. And like, I think it just, what it boils down to is like, you can just do the benchmark. Look at the performance. It's like 3 gigabytes per second read and write, roughly. So I think it's a little bit less for write, right? So the debate about single versus dual, the feedback we got is that it's not actually a dual module. It's just one module that's split into two bits of silicon. But the bottom line is that, what is it, like 4 PCI Express lanes going to this controller?
Yes.
Like you get the results you get. And, you know, whether it's because they're dual or it's just one good way, they could have put it on a single chip if for different packaging reasons, is that they are giving you the PCI Express lanes to get maximum performance out of the SSDs, and that the performance is better than any other Mac, essentially. And did you ask them about the encryption stuff as well?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I didn't have a lot of questions on it because I didn't know enough to ask really about. But yeah, it is certainly it's doing all the encryption in hardware, like in the T2. So there's two different types of encryption going on here. There's the hardware encryption, kind of like what iOS devices have, where like the actual data on the flash is encrypted. Even if you're not using File Vault, it is encrypted. And if you take that SSD stick or whatever it is out of the iMac Pro and put it in some kind of enclosure or another iMac Pro to try to read it, you won't be able to, because the key to decrypt it is, you know, secure enclave style, stored on that T2. The reading of the flash is tied to that hardware. So the only way to read the data on the flash is if you can get that computer to read it for you. If you do things like set a firmware password or something, obviously that's going to provide pretty good security on that, so it can't boot other things. I didn't ask too much about what's different now with the new secure boot stuff, with things like firmware passwords and boot options and whether it will boot external media and stuff like that. I know a lot of that has changed, mostly for the better, in fact, maybe entirely for the better. So I can't really talk about that because I don't know enough about it yet. So there's that level of encryption. And you can also use File Vault on top of that. And if you do use File Vault, its encryption instructions are now hardware accelerated. So that's not even running on the Xeon. It's running on the T2. It's not taxing the Xeon at all.
Hardware accelerated. You got my pet peeve again. Oh, now it's hardware accelerated. Instead of being executed on hardware, it'll be executed on hardware. I know. But yeah, you got the important point, is that you don't have to make, the CPU won't be involved in this. So most people are speculating what performance hit do you get for using encryption with HFS Plus or APFS, and you could measure it, and you know, Apple's like, it's really small or whatever, and I think some testing has shown that the hit might actually be more with APFS than it was with HFS Plus, whether it's because it's better encryption or whatever. Theoretically, well, first of all, you know, assuredly this will give you more CPU because your CPU won't be doing any encryption stuff. None, zero. It'll all be done by the T2, which is great. Like, I like the idea of these little custom coprocessors handling this very specific function. Surely they have instructions just for it. It's great. The second possibility that someone will have to benchmark to find out is, okay, your CPU is freed up. Does the T2 do that encryption job faster than the Xeon used to, because, you know, it's a dedicated type of thing? If it does, that means there will be less of a performance hit for enabling File Vault on an iMac Pro with the T2. And that's something we'll have to benchmark.
I mean, I'm guessing there's probably some kind of smart implementation detail where, because like, it's already in the T2's role as the disk controller, you know, and doing that hardware encryption the way iOS devices do, it's already encrypting everything in and out at full speed, even when File Vault's not on. So I'm guessing by using File Vault, you're probably just like having another mode of maybe of that same encryption, or having the keys combined in some way or something like that. I don't know the details enough to say, but
yeah, it could be. And if that's the case, there'll be zero speed hit, because like, it's doing it whether you have File Vault on or not. And so it's, you know, like this should be borne out by the benchmarks, but it's an intriguing possibility. This brings me back to the good old days of Philips Tri-Media Accelerator. You guys don't remember that, but
nope.
But there have been very, even in the early days of Mac OS X, which maybe you were around for and remember, the idea of Apple adding chips to max to make them faster in basically magical ways. It's like, yeah, you can just take a CPU and some RAM and a motherboard and throw them together, but the Apple special sauce is they'll put special magic chips on there that will make your Mac better. This is the actual reality of the T2. Apple made its own chip and threw it on there. And I mean, even on Apple's own page, like the list of stuff this thing does, in addition to what we've listed, is image signal processing for the front-facing camera, audio controller, of course, the secure enclave, the encryption. Oh, actually, this is right from Apple's marketing page. The data in your SSD is encrypted using dedicated AES hardware with no effect on the SSD's performance. It's not clear whether they're talking about FileVault or the other thing. But yeah, they're actually doing something that they had very rarely done in the past, which is throwing a chip that nobody else has, to their computer specifically to make them perform better. And who doesn't like that? That is a great pro feature. And if it lets them, like, you know, these are things that you should be able to measure. If it lets them go faster on benchmarks because the CPU is not involved at all in any of the encryption on the disk stuff, that's a clean win. And if the T2, as is rumored, is heavily based on an existing iPhone chip, that's a great reuse of IP. Like, they already did the work to design this chip for their flagship product. You can repurpose this chip and throw it in with a combination of a bunch of other stuff, and maybe even repurpose some software that you have to do, say, image processing from the iPhone or whatever, you know, and maybe disk controller stuff. I don't know how much of that is shared with the iOS devices that might be using a similar thing. This is a smart way to make a better, faster computer, and I hope the Mac Pro has something just like this, even though, you know, presumably doesn't have a front-facing camera or whatever.
And I think, you know, one of the things we said when the Touch Bar was launched was, you know, this actually does show, like, they are putting significant engineering resources into the Mac still. You know, not as much as we would like sometimes, but clearly, like, it isn't just sitting around being completely neglected. Like, this wasn't like a half-assed update. This was like a significant engineering effort, and with significant new things being put into it, not just like a stock Intel motherboard and you know, stock parts. So give them, you know, full credit where credit is due. Like, this is major engineering work going into the Mac. And for a long time, it seemed like that wasn't happening. So this is a nice, you know, change of the narrative, and it's good to see results.
One aspect of this integration, by the way, of like getting to the SSD specifically, of like great performance, the encryption at rest for free, the secure enclave. This is from our anonymous source again. This person says they feel quite confident stating there will never be a third-party SSD upgrade for a T2 equipped Mac because the integration is so tight. I mean, maybe it's tight down to being soldered in, or maybe it's tight just down to, like, this is not something you can buy off the shelf. There's tight integration between the storage and the controller and the encryption and all that other stuff going on there, that it is a very custom solution. And that is very much like iOS devices, where no one considers, you know, upgrading the storage. You buy a 64 gig phone, you're like, oh, I'll aftermarket upgrade it to 128. No, you won't. Like, because it's so integrated into, like, everything inside a phone has from day one been so tied up with the whole security environment of phones. And the T2 brings the Mac closer to that ideal in good ways and bad. We haven't gotten to the secure boot stuff yet, but, like, bring it closer to the ideal of a phone, of being more resilient to hardware attacks. Like, the old adage in the world of desktop and even laptop computers is physical access trumps all security. Even servers, physical access trumps all security. If you are physically there with the hardware, doesn't really matter what you've done security-wise, because if you're physically there, there are so many things that you can do to own that machine, right? With phones, the whole idea has been to make them resilient to that old adage. Does physical access trump security? Here you go. Here's my phone. If Apple has done a good job, it should be really hard for you to get anything out of it, like anything at all, aside from you maybe, like, freezing the thing in liquid nitrogen and extracting the data from RAM. But even then, it might be encrypted. Like, you know, so anyway, the T2 and the associated secure boot machinery and secure enclave and all that stuff are an attempt to bring the Mac more into that direction, for good and bad. Mostly good in terms of security, but bad in terms of us as computer enthusiasts who occasionally screw up on our computers have gotten used to the idea that, you know, physical access trumps all security is good for us when we mess up our own computers. Say, well, it's all messed up, but because I'm physically here in front of the computer, I'm going to plug in this other drive and boot from it. Or, you know, I'm going to go in target disk mode and just pull the data off or whatever. Like, you know, even though I've hosed my OS install by messing with the bootloader or some crap. Like, there's always something we can do to save ourselves. not so much with an iPhone, and maybe not so much with one of these iMac Pros either, depending on how you have it configured.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why, like, I would strongly advise, similar to the RAM argument, like, don't assume you're going to be able to upgrade these later. You know, as you said, like, we heard from that anonymous tip, they don't think that it's likely that we're going to have upgradable SSDs from third parties. I didn't ask this during the call, so I don't have any kind of official statement on this, but I would guess the same thing. It seems very likely that that's going to be the case. That I don't think you're going to see third-party T2 SSD modules. And, you know, as we briefly discussed last week, I don't think that's that different from how it is now. Like, the last few generations of Macs that we've had, you haven't had third-party SSD modules usually at all, or if they do come, they come, like, years after the machine is launched. And they're usually very expensive because they're, like, custom stuff from OWC or something like that. So, like, if you can at all order your computer with the disk space you need up front, do it. And otherwise consider external expansion, because internal upgrades down the road are just getting less and less likely to be possible or affordable.
So the secure boot stuff, Cable did a bunch of tweets about it because he got one too, right? He's another developer who got one of these.
Yeah, he got a review unit.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He didn't just get a call. He actually got a computer, which is cool. So he did a bunch of tweets about it. One of them was a screenshot of a new... I guess it's an app called Startup Security Utility, and it's where you can enable and disable the firmware password, but it also has two little sets of radio buttons, one called Secure Boot, and the options are Full Security, which I don't know what the defaults are, but Full Security ensures that only the latest and most secure software can be run. And this mode requires a network connection at software installation time. I'm a little bit confused about the details of that, because ensures that only the latest and most secure software can run. Does that mean, like, if it's not the latest software, it won't boot it, but it will force you to do an update before it will even boot? I don't know. Anyway, medium security requires verifiable software to boot, but not the latest software, so you can just keep using your old OS. And no security does not enforce any requirement. So all of our Macs now fall under the category, as far as secure boot is concerned, of no security. Like, if there's an interesting name for what Apple thinks of this thing. If you plug in a drive that has an OS that can boot your machine, it will boot, right? It doesn't do any verification that that operating system is, like, completely valid and hasn't been rooted, and it sure doesn't care if it's the latest version. You know, you can, whatever, like my 2008 Mac Pro, what did it ship with? Did it ship with Snow Leopard? Maybe before that. Maybe it shipped with Leopard. Yeah, I think it shipped with Leopard. It'll boot Leopard right now. It doesn't care that Leopard is ancient. Like, so that's what Apple considers no security. And there's also an option for external boot. And you can select disallow booting from external media, which is pretty straightforward. It's like, oh, you messed up your computer? You want to boot from another disk to try to save it? Nope, not if you have this thing set. Or the option to allow booting from external media. So a lot of the T2 stuff is like, you know, you can make your iMac much more like an iPhone. Or if you change these settings, it can just be like a normal Mac has always been. Now, it's clear the direction Apple wants you to go in. The top items and all these radio buttons are the most secure ones. But there's an interesting TechNote help article that I'll put a link to that, like, what do you do if you have your iMac Pro set to the most secure settings and you screw it up? The recovery procedure, kind of like the recovery procedure when you, like, screw up your phone and you have to sort of go into DFU mode or whatever, the recovery procedure for your iMac Pro requires you to have another Mac and that you can connect to your iMac Pro. And if you think about it, it's like, look, you know, you always need some other thing to plug your thing into. Like, when you put your phone in DFU mode, if you don't literally have any other hardware, it just sits there staring at you. Like, it's not, you need some other device to connect it to. In the case of the Mac Pro, what you need to connect it to, it would be kind of neat if you connected to an iPhone to recover it. Like, it would download from the internet the OS update and funnel it through. But anyway, this is the brave new world of security. The whole point of all the secure boot software is so that your computer can verify that it is running, like, you know, clean software that, you know, there's this sort of chain of trust that each thing in the chain verifies the next thing. What was it? Cable had a good tweet about it. The new chip means that storage encryption keys pass from the secure enclave to the hardware encryption engine on chip. Your key never leaves the chip and allows the hardware verification of the OS, the kernel, the bootloader, the firmware, etc. And each component in turn verifies the next. So it's a chain of trust starting with the secure enclave, essentially, so that each thing that runs next knows that it is being kicked off from something that is secure. And it's the way the phone security works, and it's the way this security works. And it's, you know, It's not like it's foolproof. Like any security thing, if there's a flaw, it can be exploited to get in. That's how jailbreaks have always worked. Like, it's not, you know, it's not impenetrable, but it is a far cry from the world of all the Macs that we're sitting in front of now, which is like la-di-da, they'll boot whatever the heck you give them. They have no idea if your operating system has been, you know, rootkitted or whatever. They have no idea how new it is when they're booting, and this iMac changes all that.
I wonder a little bit, like, you know, one of the problems that I have with High Sierra is that it's pretty buggy still, but yet Apple's really pushing it heavily through, like, the auto-update mechanism and stuff like that. The idea that, like, you know, to have the best security, you should be running the latest OS is often true, but not always true. And sometimes running the latest OS has other downsides, like certain things that are still broken or too different or that break your workflow, like, you know, dropping support for some old app that you use or something like that. I wonder, like, how this mechanism will be useful in practice if you want to still use the old OS for a while because the new one isn't good enough yet or doesn't support the things you need to support yet. Is this going to force you to upgrade unless you turn down your security to the medium level? Like,
you'd have to change down to medium security, which, you know, like, they're loaded terms, full versus medium. But for exactly the reasons you stated, it's great that they give you these options. Like, that you don't have to go to no security. Unlike, for example, what is the thing on the Mac called? The thing that protects all your, like, system files?
System Integrity Protection, SIP?
Yeah, there we go, SIP. That you can either have that on or off, and maybe there's some developer mode that's kind of in between you there, but very often it's like, look, to use this fancy piece of software, you have to disable System Integrity Protection. And even I, who am willing to hack their Mac up a little bit, I'm also like, it really makes me rethink whether I want to completely disable System Integrity Protection, because I like the protection, the additional protection it provides. Additionally, protection from myself screwing up my own computer by modifying system files, which I, you know, have done in the past, right? So it makes me think twice about doing it. Having medium security where it requires verifiable software at a boot, meaning that it verifies that, like, these are legit copies of everything, the bootloader, the kernel, everything else, but does not require you to have the latest software. That's the mode that I think is most appealing, maybe all the time, but certainly when a new release comes out, because if the machine literally will refuse to boot until it updates itself, that is a behavior that I think pro customers will not appreciate. So again, I have no idea what the default is, but remember, you know, if you get one of these machines, remember to use this utility and pick the option that makes the most sense for you. I mean, even if only, like, if it refused to boot until it had the latest and it literally had to run the software update to High Sierra, for all you know, that is like causing the latest version of Adobe Creative Suite not to launch, right? Like, you know, if your pro machine that you use to do work every day, you come in one morning to try to do work and it's like, oh, I won't even boot until I update myself. And then after it boots, the application that you use on this all day doesn't launch anymore because it's not yet compatible. That's not a great experience. So medium security sounds like a good compromise for most people. And disallow booting from external media. Like, are you in an environment where physical security is actually that important to you, or do you want the option of saving your own butt if you screw something up by plugging in an external drive? I feel like I would leave that on allow booting from external media, but everyone's security exposure and environment is different. Maybe you're working on the next Star Wars movie, and it's really important that if someone breaks into the office, they would have a really difficult time getting your computer to boot from their external drive in target disk mode so they can copy all your precious files off of it.
All right, and then a couple other just little tidbits that I asked about or a little bits of information I've picked up since then. Quick thing, the PCI Express layout. I know this sounds really boring. Trust me, there's a reason I'm saying it. It has the GPU running on 16 lanes. It has two Thunderbolt controllers running on 4 lanes each, so 8 total. And the 10 gig Ethernet port runs on 4 lanes. All those are directed to the CPU. Everything else, including the T2, is done through the DMI, which goes to what used to be called the South Bridge. I think, I don't know if Intel still calls it the South Bridge anymore, but it's like the controller on the chipset that controls like USB and all sorts of other, like, you know, lower speed peripherals than like the GPU. The T2 is the largest bandwidth consumer through that bus, and the DMI bus seems to have approximately the same bandwidth as 4 PCI Express lanes. And you can see that in the benchmarks of the SSD, that basically the SSD clearly can run with the bandwidth of 4 PCI Express lanes. So that does seem to be pretty good. I didn't ask, because I got this information after the call, so I didn't ask why the T2 wasn't connected to one of the CPU lanes directly, because the CPU has 48 lanes, and by my count, only 28 of them are being used, or at least only 28 that I can account for. But the reason I bring this up, a lot of people look at this machine and they wonder, why do we have to pay for Xeons? Why can't Apple just ship a cheap tower that I want that has an i7 chip in it or whatever? This is one of the reasons. I said, like, so the best i7 that you can get in, say, the regular iMac has 16 lanes from the CPU total. This is using 28 of them. This shows you, like, if you drop down to one of the consumer CPUs, you would be required to cut throughput or to cut possible bandwidth on some of these components. And maybe you won't notice. Like, some people argue, well, you can cut a GPU down to X8, down from X16, and it's fine. Well, yeah, maybe it's fine, but is it the best it can be? Like, you know, getting to John's argument, like, is that the best or is it fine? So it is very clear that, like, they are using the throughput of the Xeon here. And one of the reasons I was thinking about this was kind of trying to do some research on, like, do they have enough free PCI Express lanes coming off the CPU in a theoretical Mac Pro that they could offer multiple card slots while also supporting more than one GPU with an X16 connectivity lane? And the answer appears to be yes. It appears to be they can probably offer two X16 GPUs and still have enough lanes for other stuff. But I'm not, like, I don't think they would also offer additional PCI Express slots beyond maybe just those two. All this was, you know, theoretical, trying to educate myself to make better Mac Pro predictions. And then finally, I asked if they're still, remember when the 5K iMac first launched? At the time, Thunderbolt 2 was not powerful enough to drive a 5K display at 60 hertz. It didn't have enough bandwidth to drive a 5K display at 60 hertz. And Apple made a big deal about it, even during the presentation, pointing out they had developed their own timing controller, or TCON, and they had embedded that in the iMac to help drive the display by basically multiplexing two streams together. I asked if they still do that. The answer, yes. So there's because I figured, like, you know, that now things are faster. Maybe they wouldn't need that anymore. But nope, they still do it. So that's useful to somebody, maybe. And then finally, I asked if the AppleCare pricing is a mistake or not, because whether you, so that, you know, one of the little flukes about AppleCare pricing is that Apple keeps flat pricing for a product family. So if you look at, like, a MacBook Pro, the price of AppleCare for a $2,000 configuration of the 15-inch MacBook Pro, that's the same price whether you get the base model or whether you spec up all the specs and it costs like $5,000. AppleCare stays the same price because it's just the price of what it is for a MacBook Pro. The iMac Pro is classified as an iMac for AppleCare purposes. And so whether you spend literally $1,300 or $13,000, AppleCare is the same price of $169. And when I ordered this, like, you know, it shows you, like, on the second page, it shows, like, the order screen of, like, you know, do you want to add the AppleCare to your cart? I thought it was a mistake. I'm like, there's no way that, like, a $10,000 configuration of this computer, that AppleCare is under $200. There's no way. But it turns out that is not a mistake. That's just what it costs. So this is one of those things that, you know, I say, like, I buy AppleCare selectively based on the economics involved in each decision. I would definitely recommend buying it on an iMac Pro, just because, you know, A, these are really expensive parts if you ever need to get them serviced. You know, I would assume that servicing this is going to cost more simply because the components are more advanced and higher end and will cost more. And B, that is such a cheap price for AppleCare relative to the cost of the machine that it seems like an exceptionally good deal in this case.
One thing about the PCI Express lanes, back in the cheese grater days, maybe all the cheese grater days, I think they had like one good slot for your good card and then one slot with like half the number of lanes. But for the purposes of in those days, for the purposes of having like a crossfire dual GPUs for games and stuff like that, most games could get by with 8 lanes instead of 16. So you'd put one card in the 16, one card in the 8, but just run them the same speed and they would, you know, work. Or just having two cards to have like a larger number of monitors. Back before you could drive 10,000 monitors off of your laptops, it was a big deal to have two video cards, each of which could drive two monitors, and you get a big setup like that. So it's conceivable that a Mac Pro could have one 16X slot and then a bunch of slower slots, some of which you'd still put cards in, especially if you just want to expand the number of monitors. If you, who knows, maybe you're making some weird simulation thing that needs 15 monitors, right? If you have enough slots, it doesn't matter that they're not all 16 lanes. You just need enough to drive a monitor, right? So there's a lot of flexibility. I continue to think that card slots won't be what the Mac Pro is about, but who knows? Like, you just need a couple of slots to make it so much better than zero slots, right? And I would be perfectly happy if there was only one 16X slot in there, and then just, you know, one or two lesser ones, or even zero lesser ones, because all I really care about is the ability to upgrade the GPU. But other people's mileage may vary. I do wonder about slots in the Mac Pro. How has Apple successfully entirely killed the market for any card you can buy to stick in a Mac? I mean, I suppose not, because a lot of PC cards will still work in there, or will work in there with some, you know, minor change, right? But it's not as if there's tons and tons of cards being sold to Mac users, because what would they put them in? It's been many, many years since Apple has sold a computer brand new that takes expansion cards, PCI, you know, Express cards in them. So I have to imagine if you were in the market of selling whatever, cards for whatever that go inside a Mac, that's been a difficult market for a while, right? So, you know, that's something to watch for. Like, it seems like there's plenty of lanes to go around. It gives Apple lots of flexibility. Apple could certainly use them all on a Mac Pro, but I would not be absolutely shocked if it turns out that even in the biggest, beefiest configuration of Mac Pro, there was actually still a couple of lanes left over for something.
Well, and, you know, maybe the eGPU situation now will keep that market alive for compute cards and GPUs. Like, I don't expect that market to come back for things like video capture cards. Like, that was like some of the big uses of PCI cards in the past have been like custom high end video capture cards, certain RAID controllers and stuff like that. Like, that's probably not coming back.
Or even like putting USB 3 in a really old cheese grater, stuff like that. Like, I mean, these tiny little cards that look like they're, you know, embarrassingly small. Like, they don't even think they should be taking up a card slot. Like, they're there's lots of things that you can do, and those cards don't have to be super Mac specific. They can, again, lengthen the life of your computer by giving an interface that it didn't have before or whatever. Even like a 10 gig Ethernet card and a Mac Pro that didn't come with 10 gig Ethernet or whatever.
I would guess that the only likely role of card slots in a new Mac Pro is GPUs / compute cards. If they do that, I'm guessing there's a limit of two slots. If for nothing else, for bandwidth or for just sheer size, or Apple being Apple not wanting to offer you a ton of PCI slots because they view those as unnecessary / the past / a burden. And all of those, I think today that would be a reasonable position to take. As long as you can support GPUs and compute cards, I think you're okay. So Casey, are you still with us?
Hi.
So now comes my final thought on this for this 10-minute period. So, you know, they call this the iMac Pro. And John said he'll never buy one.
Right. When did I say I would never buy one? I don't recall saying that.
Like an hour ago. But I think it's very, very clear by looking, you know, look at what this machine actually is. The only reason it's called iMac is because it has a closed back and a screen on the front. But by all accounts, this is a Mac Pro. Like, the reason we're talking about it so much, the reason we're so excited, the reason it's so damn fast is because it's a Mac Pro. It's in everything but name and shape. But it isn't, like, even the shape is not that different from what we had from 2013 forward. One of the reasons I'm so happy about this is that we've been crowing for years for a Mac Pro update. Well, they just gave us one. This is a Mac Pro update. And it isn't exactly what everybody wants. Like, a lot of people still want the, you know, what an expandable headless tower will offer them. And I might be one of these too. You know, I'll decide when it comes out. But I'm just really excited about this machine because they gave us a new Mac Pro. It's a Mac Pro, period. No matter what they call it, this is a Mac Pro. And that's really great. I'm really excited about that. I just cannot wait to be using a Mac Pro again, even if there's an extra letter in front of it.
We'll see how excited you are when you have to bring it in for image retention.
Yeah, I'm honestly a little worried about service issues like that.
It was like the most prosaic things, like the guts of it all were great, but it like the screen ends up being, you know, it's the all-in-one factor, like that if something goes wrong with it, even if everything else is working fine, the whole thing has to go in. So anyway, and it's been brought up by a lot of other people, and I've been thinking about it lately too as I sit here in front of my nearly 10-year-old monitor. That 5K screen in iMac is great. Tying it to, like, it's going to age much more slowly than the internals, because it's not like the 5K screen is going to be cutting edge forever. Say 8K screens come out, it's like, oh, that stinky 5K screen. But that 5K screen will be a great screen for years and years and years and years. Like, you could keep, assuming it was reliable and it kept working, you're not going to turn your nose up at that screen anytime soon. Like, there is no second retina revolution where we have another 5x increase in resolution, because there's no benefit to that. Maybe HDR will start to make it crappy, but
if we got OLED on the desktop to have like those real OLED black levels, oh man, that'd be great. But that doesn't seem like it's happening soon.
Oh, yeah, OLED and HDR. But I say, because I'm sitting in front of a 10-year-old monitor, this monitor is not retina. It's not great. The black levels on it are atrocious, but it still looks nice. Like, and here's what my qualifier for looking nice, especially with Apple monitors: color uniformity and general sharpness goes a long way, right? The fact that this is still, like, if I make the screen entirely white, I can't tell there's, like, a dark splotch and a light splotch and stuff like that. No image retention as far as I'm able to tell. All the pixels are still alive. Looks about as good as the day I got it. Yeah, it's small, but, you know, if I wasn't me, I could have been using this monitor with a series of Macs, right? And it kind of makes me feel bad about it. I have a 27-inch Thunderbolt display up in the attic, which granted is an external display, but because it's like a Thunderbolt weirdness, I don't have stuff to plug it into without a dongle type adapter. But I, you know, and if I could have plugged that into my current Mac and it wasn't 10 years old, I would have. But anyway, all this is to say that for all of the iMac Pro's greatness, all-in-one is still an all-in-one, and it's great for what you want it to be, but the all-in-one compromises are still there, and you have to be aware of them. And no matter how awesome they make the internals, nothing changes the stripes of an all-in-one being an all-in-one. And mostly I think about it because that, you know, maybe I think about it because my wife's monitor and her 5K iMac looks so much better than the thing that I sit in front of every day. But I'm like, man, I would love to use that as a monitor. And I know that it will never happen. When the guts of that 5K iMac become old and slow, I can't just use it as a monitor for another machine, which you could do with one of the older non-retina iMacs, if I recall correctly. But anyway, what I'm saying is I'm looking forward to the Pro display almost as much as the Mac Pro.
Yeah, I really am very excited to see what that ends up being. But honestly, like, if we didn't have anything, any hope of a Mac Pro coming, you know, if we didn't have that you know, the statements from Apple saying they're working on one, if this was it, if this was the only thing that was going to be the new Mac Pro, that's not bad. It would still be amazing. I would still be very excited.
I would have ordered it. If that was the case, I would have ordered it, and I wouldn't have been too grumpy about ordering it. I mean, I would have got my grump about... here's what I would have been grumpy about. I would have been grumpy about the fact that I'm making a Mac Pro, but I wouldn't have been that grumpy about having to order this, because I would, you know... Like, at various times, I have actually considered replacing my Mac Pro with a 5K when in my darkest times. And it's clear that the 5K is not like a Mac Pro in any stretch of the imagination. It's consumer CPUs. It's, you know, like, but it would be, you know, at a certain point, it's a big upgrade. So I would mostly be complaining about why aren't you going to make a Mac Pro? But then when it came to like, okay, fine, if you're not going to make a Mac Pro and you're not going to do that thing, I guess I'll settle for what you do get. And settling for the iMac Pro is a hell of a lot better than settling for a 5K iMac. So
come on. I mean, I admire your enthusiasm, John. I really do. But both of you would be going bananas. Maybe yeah, not I mean, Marco after this phone call, but up until this phone call, the two of you would be inconsolable about how this is BS. They're not taking pros seriously. I want expansion. I want to be able to get inside of it.
Yeah, that would be true, but it would be less about complaining about specifically the iMac Pro and more about complaining, where is the Mac Pro and how are you, you know, all the people you're abandoning with not making Mac Pro. I mean, the whole thing, they had the April, but we don't have to do that. Like, they changed their mind. Everyone's all happy. We're just waiting patiently.
Well, also, like, a lot of those ships sailed with the 2013 Mac Pro. Like a lot, like a lot of that was like, oh, you can't expand it anymore. They killed all the slots. They made it really expensive. Like that all happened in 2013. So like we would have considered that like already a lost cause.
Yeah, and I think I was less angry about the 2013 because I think I and a lot of other people just assumed, okay, well this is the first one. This is the first trash can.
Right.
Like, give them a break. Like they're gonna, you know, the second and third generation trash cans will surely be great. And that was turned out to be a mistake, but that's why we weren't like, oh, I don't like this 2013 trash can. I didn't buy one. I said, this is not for me. I'll wait for the second or third gen. You know, once you can hook a Retina monitor up to it, how long did we talk about that? It just, we made assumptions that were not founded, that computer would be updated. I hope Marco is not correct about this Mac Pro, because honestly, whatever this Mac Pro is, if you do not have a 10-year-old computer like me, you'd be wise to wait for the second generation of this one, but maybe you wouldn't be, because if Marco's theory is right and there never will be a second generation of this new Mac Pro, it would be very unwise to wait for it, and you should just get an iMac Pro now and just be happy. So, I don't know. I have no choice. I have to get the Mac Pro when it comes out. It's just been too darn long, but I worry about it being a one-and-done computer, because that's not what I want from it.
Well, but, I mean, at least if it is, you'll have 10 more years probably use out of it.
If it doesn't have overheating GPUs or some other weird thing, who knows? I mean, it's going to be an octagon, and it will spin when you use it. I don't know. who knows what this thing will be.
Like a rotating restaurant.
Yeah.
Ay-ay-ay.
All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace, Backblaze, and Aftershocks. We will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental.
Accidental.
Oh, it was accidental.
Accidental.
John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental.
Accidental.
Oh, it was accidental.
Accidental.
And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse, it's accidental.
How is it talking to Apple?
It was pretty cool.
I hear, you know, all the things you said. I've been here. I just didn't have anything to add. But that's got to be pretty neat.
Oh, yeah. It was mostly just like, you know, an honor that they decided to take their time to talk to me. You know, like, you know, mm-hmm. I wasn't talking to like Tim, but I was talking to people who matter in Apple, who have busy things that they could be doing. Like, you know, like they have busy schedules, and in the middle of this launch, they have to talk to a lot of people, and they decided to talk to me for like an hour.
Did you ask them when your review unit would arrive?
No, I did not. I did not presume that I'm getting a review unit, and I told them right up front, because they asked if I ordered one, and I said yes. So.
Oh, you should have said no. I'm waiting for my review unit, right?
Oh, my word.
Yeah, but yeah. So it's mostly just an honor, and the call also just went really well. Like, you know, it wasn't. You know, if you might think talking to Apple is, you know, like the way Tim Cook is in TV interviews, like, you know, very careful, reserved, a little bit cold, maybe. But no, it isn't like that. Like, these are just humans who are, you know, on the call trying to be helpful to you, trying to be friendly. And again, like, they're not going to, like, let slip something about the next iPhone or anything. But, you know, you're still talking to people. You're not talking to, like, a robot. So it's just a nice, friendly call.
Sounds to me like you got handled by Apple PR.
Oh, we're definitely gonna have people you know, who say that, but you know, look, I brought a bunch of questions to them. Some of them were a little bit challenging or difficult, and they, you know, they took them all in stride and told me what they wanted to tell me. And you know, I'm not going into this saying that you know, because I talked to them, everything's going to be perfect about this computer. I don't know yet, but so far it seems pretty great, and I hope that I've been fair in representing my opinion and my thoughts here. Like, I don't want to make it sound like now that they talk to me, I'm going to say only the good things and be brainwashed and everything else. It just sounds like this is really a really good computer. And I think most of the early reviews bear that out. We will see what happens once I get one, once we get one, if John ever buys one, and over time we will see, like, are there any long-term problems that develop, like reliability issues or heat or things like that. But so far it seems pretty great, and from what we know so far, I don't see any of those problems on the horizon anymore. You know, I was very concerned about thermals before. Between what they've said and what other people have said who have seen or used or who have one of these computers, that doesn't seem to be a problem. So maybe that's great. We'll find out. I do hope that I'm representing these things, you know, fairly, and that I'm not, you know, unreasonably biased because they're being friendly towards me. But I don't think I am. I think I'm being reasonable here. But if I am, I know you guys will tell me. And if not, all of the listeners will.
Oh, of course you are. I mean, you can't help but be influenced by that. But, you know, as long as you call out the fact that you may be influenced by it, I feel like listeners should be able to take that into account.
Yeah, sure. You know? I mean, and, you know, the other thing is, like, when I talk to people at Apple, I don't pull punches. And I also, I'm not, like, super apologetic or deferential or anything. I just treat them as peers. And part of that is because I don't have a real job and I don't really have a boss or anything. And so I don't really treat anybody like they're my boss. And part of that is that as I increasingly get into my my mid-30s, soon to be my late-30s, I just don't care anymore about anything. So
can that be the title? I just don't care anymore about anything. It's the follow-up to my autobiography, Nobody Cares But Me, But I Do Care. Second volume, Marco Arment. I just don't care anymore about anything.
No, but like, well done. Like I'm not afraid. If I'm talking to somebody at Apple, I'm not afraid of, like, you know, if I say the wrong thing, or if I afterwards, if I'm on a podcast and I say the wrong thing, like, are they going to cut off, you know, my PR access or something? Because until this moment, I didn't have PR access.
You don't have any PR access to get cut off.
I don't, like, I have nothing to lose. And also, everything in my job, everything in my career, my life to this point has not needed PR access. And so, like, it's one thing, like, if I was, like, The Verge and I get cut off from PR, that's a much bigger problem. For me to get cut off from PR, it doesn't really hurt me much. And so I'm not afraid to be honest and to say when things are bad. And most good journalists, you know, they try to maintain that same balance, even if their access does depend on that, because, you know, even if their access does or does not, their credibility depends on them being balanced and being fair and being willing to criticize when it's warranted. And so I'm not saying everybody with PR access is afraid to criticize, but that is definitely a trap that I would fear falling into, you know, if my access increases. But I think I'm okay because I don't really have anything to lose.
I have to say, one of the best things about Apple PR in my experience is because they're so selective in who they talk to, they tend to know who they're talking to. So they will tailor not just what they say, but even who you talk to. Like at various times in my macOS 10 reviews, I had interactions with Apple PR. And in almost all those cases, I didn't have to go through, like, you know, the analogy being like level one, level two, level three support. They would just hook me up directly with the engineer who works on whatever thing that I want to ask about. Now, partially it's because I'm asking questions that Apple PR thinks are the most boring questions in the world. Like, you know, tell me about the exact technical details of some subsystem that I'm going to put in my umpteen page review that no one is going to read all of, right? So they don't care. But the thing is, they're efficient. They're not going to make me ask a question of a high-level PR person who's then going to ask someone below that, who's then going to ask an engineering manager, who then is going to ask an engineer through this giant game of telephone to get back to me. They just will connect me directly to the people who know, which it sounds like, they would never let an engineer talk directly to the press. They do. They do if they know who they're talking to and what they're asking about, and the parameters are very clear that you're just specifically asking about exactly how Facebook integration works with contacts in some specific version of the operating system. And as most people know, the engineers will just tell you the truth. They wrote the thing. They designed the subsystem. It's a boring answer to a boring question that doesn't reveal anything about future anything. But very often I had those kind of specific questions. And to Apple's credit, they didn't say, oh, you know, we're not talking about that now, or we'll get back to you, or give me some vague generality that's just reading from a web page you can get. They'll bring you right down to the engineer. So I would imagine when they're talking to Marco, they've got people sort of appropriately scaled to the type of questions that he's likely to ask, which would be very different than if they're talking to, you know, Time Magazine or whatever. It's a different set of people because they know who it is they're talking to.
Yeah, I asked, you know, very technical questions, very specific questions about implementation details of the iMac and things like its processors and its PCI lanes. And I got answers to all of those questions from the people on the call. Like, they knew their stuff. Anyway, like, you know, my attitude towards them is very much like, I love talking to them, but I don't need to be talking to them. Like, my job does not depend on it. And so I hope that will help, you know, basically keep me in check here from getting, you know, too biased, I guess.
But we still all want review hardware, so Apple, please send it.
Well, and the funny thing is, like, even if I don't get review hardware, that doesn't really
affect
this.
You're just going to buy it. But right. For those of us who aren't going to buy every single thing, review hardware, and this sounds like, oh, you get review hardware. Like, you don't get to keep it. Like, you give it back to them. It's just so that you can talk in it in a more informed way on your media event, you know, like, so you can write about it for your website or so you can talk about it on your podcast. I continue to maintain that podcast is a form of media, though Apple seems not yet to entirely agree when it comes to review units. But anyway, it's, if Apple decides they want to get their message out through a particular person or venue or whatever, review hardware is a great way to do that. Even if they don't get it early, even if you just get it day of, it just lets that person know what it's like to use that thing and then give it back after a week. And that's part of the PR effort. So I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that someday that Apple could give podcast review hardware. It just doesn't happen yet. So I'm saying we're willing to be in that pilot program. Call us, Apple.
Yeah, maybe for a major desktop Mac release in 2018.
Mm-hmm. Just send it right to Casey's house.
That would be so amazing.
You can pick it up in the back of his Jeep Wrangler and just whip down the highway with it.
Oh my God! Can you imagine? Can you imagine if I got on the horn one day and was like, "Hey, you know that Mac Pro that's not coming out for a week? Yeah, you know, the good news is I have one. The bad news is I just couldn't be bothered by unboxing it, so I'm not going to be able to talk about it at all." You two would lose it.
The bad news is it fell out of my Jeep Wrangler because I didn't have the doors on.
Yeah, it went over a big bump and it just tumbled out the back. But it seems like it's fine.
I'm sure it'll be okay. It's all solid state. There's no platters.
It's got a glass front and back like the new phones.